monthly payment Thursday, 27th of March, 2019, communications from the church. As honorable members are aware, it is a requirement under Section 69(1) of the Constitution that the estimated expenditure for the next financial year be circulated to honorable members on a confidential basis not later than the 30th of April. Since the House is not due to meet next month, I am proposing that the provisions of the Constitution will be deemed to have been met if the estimates are circulated to all honorable members before the end of April. This is what we have been doing for the last 2 years, and so I propose that it should be the case again for this year. Is that agreed?
We now continue with answers to all questions. We commence with question number 214, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the number of complaints made by our force, the Royal Gibraltar Police, for alleged criminal acts by students and teachers in the last 24 months?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the answer is two. I'm just looking for, obviously, not the identity of the perpetrator, but the offences themselves. I would very much say that across the chamber, but I would be very happy to inform the honourable member behind your chair. It might just be that by mentioning the cases, it may be possible to identify the person in a case as small as the greater. So I would rather not do that, but I would give him the information immediately with a translator. I'm happy for that method to be deployed in respect of this matter, but insofar as people reference are concerned, clearly we can identify categories of offences rather than individual offences themselves. If it's essential for this group, I'm willing to take the minister so far, and we can have a discussion on speaker's turn.
Question number 214, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can you demonstrate the number of referrals made by our schools to social services in the last 24 months?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
This is 61 direct referrals from schools to the care agency. Mr. Speaker, given the significant volume of referrals to the care agency, can the Minister confirm the category or type of complaints, or again, is this an issue that could identify 61, 20 or 40 students themselves?
Mr. Speaker, when I'm talking about two of the previous questions, it's much easier to identify. In 61, I would not have a problem, but as I already specifically asked that, the question clearly said the number. I don't have that information. But I would be happy to provide it for him. I would ask him if he wouldn't mind writing to me so that I don't leave it undone. But it's a different case. When you have 61, but when you have two, it's more easy to identify. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 216, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state its policy in respect to the funding of foundation degree programs?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, foundation degrees are discretionary in nature. The exception to this are isolated courses where the only route to an undergraduate program is via the foundation course.
Mr. Speaker, I may be wrong, but my memory at the moment is that the scholarship publication in the newspaper and the Chronicle recently stated that the funding of foundation programs would not be provided and it would not be entertained as an application. Can you also clarify that statement in the adverts of the press?
Mr. Speaker, I can't recall the word in the advert, but the situation is that applicants for foundation degree courses would be considered, but in a discretionary manner. The problem, Speaker, is that I think we're developing, and some universities are looking at funding and so on,
willing to provide foundation courses in cases where A-level results are not particularly good. And one has to be wary of rewarding students who may not be working hard on an A-level and the belief that they're going to be well out of a foundation course. This is why it's discretionary. And there would be an element of considering the student's work during the A-level years in considering that. But I do know for a fact that they are considered, and very often they are given. But in some cases, the board considers that it would not be a good investment in money.
So, as part of the policy, do the government consider the potential leapfrog from the foundation program to the full degree? And in that consideration, do the government consider the need of our community at large in respect of that degree?
Because I don't have all the details of how the board of considered to deal with it. Do you recall that all new degrees, as opposed to foundation degrees, where a student has a place are automatically funded, and that doesn't come to that? I would have thought, but this is subject to confirmation, I'm not involved in this at all, that there will be a whole range of considerations in considering students. The policy of the government and of the department is to encourage students who are bona fide and who would benefit from such a degree, but we have to be wary that it isn't a reflection of, you know, I don't have to bother because I'm going to go there anyway. It's something that has to be done together with what benefits the community might get from here.
Maybe just one further question about foundation degrees. Do the minister agree with it? Well, certainly in limited experience that I have with foundation programs, there are a number of students in our community that would benefit from foundation degrees, foundation programs that lead to degrees, on the basis that there are students that are not developers. They thrive in foundation degrees that are much more suitable, much more geared, particularly in the vocation areas of social care, for instance. And would the minister agree that we need to watch out for those types of students so that we can engineer them into full degrees later where they will probably thrive?
This policy is by no means aimed at discouraging that. It's the second we try to give them automatically for the other reasons that I have stated.
Okay, I think for my own clarification, the Minister has explained clearly that the awarding of the scholarship for foundation degrees is completely discretionary. Unsuccessful completion of that foundation degree, those universities expect that student to continue with a full-blown degree and then they will get exempted out of the first 2 years. Because it's an ordinary degree, does the student have to apply as a further discretionary award, or is it that it now kicks in automatically as a mandatory thing and therefore he can take it for he or she can take it for granted that the mandatory award will come through? I don't know if the minister understands what I'm asking.
Absolutely. I think those circumstances would mean that a person has got a place at university, and therefore for students who have recently left school, it would be in my view mandatory. If you're coming at a late or not, because any degree is applied for, even without a foundation year, are discretionary after 2 years from completing the study, then they would be discretionary. But certainly, if it's a student who, for example, has decided to go on a foundation course on their own back, then certainly that would be a consideration, as the Honourable Member has discussed.
Question number 2017, the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Can the government state the numbers and gender of those students who have returned to the water without completing further or higher education studies in the United Kingdom on the basis that their mental health issues have prevented them from completing the course?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to put them together with question 218.
Question number 219, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
In relation to those students who are unable to complete higher education programmes in the United Kingdom because of mental health issues, can the government state its position with respect to the obligation of the student to refund monies paid by the government in tuition and tuition restoration fees and maintenance awards?
I am for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Department of Education considers issues of mental health to be as important as any other medical condition a student might face while studying abroad. I can confirm that there were 6 students who returned to Gibraltar as a result of the medical conditions, including mental health, in 2016-17. 3 females and 3 males. I can also confirm that 3 students have returned so far in 2017-18 as a result of medical conditions. 2 females and 1 male. Students are able to complete the higher education program as a result of unavoidable purposes of their students for the guidance afforded in the scholarship contract, which requires medical evidence from a mentally qualified medical practitioner to be assessed that the student was unable to successfully complete the course for unavoidable health reasons.
Question number 219, the elderly gateway.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education provide details in respect of any changes of vacant teaching posts since the answer provided to question number 123 of 2018, indicating the school establishment where these changes may have occurred and from which state?
For the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Speaker, I think I have my questions out of sequence. What is this number then? 219. Seems to be missing from here. But if I have the answer in draft form, or maybe I have taken them two together and put them in my contract, so to speak. Apologies, Mr. Speaker. There have been no changes. Can I answer together with the information I subsequently sent my honourable friend, Mr. Hayley, other than the advertising of 18
posts. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I can come to you, with the Minister very kindly, as we have agreed, did forward me a schedule. I need your guidance, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps the Minister at some stage might be able to provide this schedule to Parliament so it becomes part of Hansard. And therefore, in a few months' time, one needs to make a reference where we turn into something that's available to all members of the House, well, that's the privileged information that the Minister has made me aware. If it is in your life, Mr. Speaker, and I'm sure the Minister can do that.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Speaker. You will recall that there was a slight difference in interpretation. We had agreed beforehand that I would send the information, and I did quite soon after that. I hope the third is available. I will make it available and it can be formed part of Hundred. So, delighted to do that.
Question number 220, the Honourable Eagle Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Now, question 220. Can the Minister for Education inform the House how many cancellations have been necessary as any of the facilities made available for community use since the 1st of January 2018, indicating the location, date, and reason for cancellation?
And for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, information required in the schedule that I'm handing over.
Question number 221, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
Further to the answer provided to question number 130 of 2018, can the Minister for Education provide details of who composed the two different working parties looking at different aspects of the key state realignment and system, as well as details of what these different aspects were?
I'm going to be over the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 222 to 233.
Question number 222, the Honourable Alex Yannis.
and the city and the government now destroy this traffic impact assessment for the new school.
Question number 223, the Albert LSM.
As a speaker, given the noise issues caused by the during the White Coast of the construction in its proximity to Bayside Comprehensive School, Albert's requirements intend to mitigate the construction of the Europort Avenue affordable housing development on the doorstep of the new St. Martin, Cabinet Mother, and Bishop of Sarah School.
Question number 224, the Albert LSM.
As a speaker, can the government explain how it will grapple with ensuring that the following recommendations from the Co-Education Group of 2007-17 is adhered to? That new entrants from the middle school sector are often daunted by the prospect of the transition to secondary education. Every attempt to better be made to ensure they are not overwhelmed by finding themselves almost overnight in an excessively populated metropolis.
Question number 225, the Albert LSM.
As a speaker, following a recent comment made by the Minister for Education that should the September 2019 deadline not be met, transitioning to new schools will take place after the Christmas or Easter break. Can the government say which schools would be foreseen to transition during the academic year and which would transition in September 2020 if any?
Question number 226, the Albert LSM.
As a speaker, when planning school locations, can the government provide details of the person's identity, is consulted, and the location considered before determining on the final location?
Question number 227, the Honourable LSM.
As a speaker, can the government state which schools will have parking spaces to meet the building footprint, detailing A, how many spaces B, if they will be sold, rented, or otherwise allocated, and C, whether these are street level or underground?
Question number 228, the
Albert LSM. Mr. Speaker, can the explain how it will manage security risks in a health school on school with underground private parking?
Question number 229, the Albert LSM.
Mr. Speaker, can the state where the evacuation meeting points where people will be in the new school?
Question number 230, the Albert LSM.
The speaker, can the government state how many pupils and individuals will attend a school secondary school if it were to open in September 2019?
Question number 231, the
Honourable Alec Lennon. The speaker, can the government state the proposed for development on the site that will be used by St. Martin School?
Question number 232, the Honourable Alec Lennon.
The speaker, can the government state what the new pupils' capacity will be at the new St. Martin School?
Question number 233, the Honourable LSM.
Mr. Speaker, has the government considered and consulted when it comes to populating these schools, to populate the schools by age, by having a lower secondary in one school and a higher secondary in another?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the Director in conjunction with the Advisory Service sets the composition of the two working parties. Staffing resources are currently the two main aspects of the two-stage realignment transition that have been identified. In relation to question 222, the mission is currently under consideration in conjunction with the Ministry for Transport. To under-continue, multiple steps will be taken and the working plan will be part of the design process. In answer to question 224, the schools have been designed accordingly. At an operational level, the school will have the capacity to ensure that the VIA group is situated on one floor to section and has very great areas for different VIA groups distinct from the rest of the school. This is in line with a further recommendation from the working group, which means initially, VIA 7 students from both Bayside and Westside would enjoy their own ecosystem, a school within a school, so to speak, and that is especially reserved for them, not quite segregated from the rest of the school, but not fully integrated either. Question 225, Mr. Speaker, no, sir. 226, these are internal discussions. In relation to 227, as plans stand, parking spaces will be provided at ground level beneath St. John's, Notre Dame, Westside, and Bayside schools. The number of spaces and the method of allocation are under consideration. All security aspects are being discussed with the relevant authorities. On question 29, the matter has been considered by the Devoted Fire and Rescue Service in conjunction with specialist fire consultants. We estimate, Mr. Speaker, that there will be a school population of approximately 1,300 students in each of Bayside and Westside schools when the schools open in September 2019. Relating to the St. Martin site, question 51, Mr. Speaker, this site has gone out for expression of interest, which had not been received and are currently being considered. In relating to question 232, Mr. Speaker, the answer is 100. And in question 233, yes, Mr. Speaker, it has, the preferred action is that the two schools will be distinct entities and will be populated separately. The schools will each run their own year 7 through to 13.
Mr. Speaker, when you come back to my own question, 221, the Minister said that the composition of the two different working parties were the director and the members of the advisory services. Does that lead me to say to conclude that it's the same people involved, or perhaps like anything that should be yet to answer?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, this answers the question of who composes the working group. I was answering the school who knows them, who made them up. The actual composition is different. The director and the advisory service decided who would be in the early stage working group. And how to facilitate the people who contend with exactly the thing. I have got that information here in case that was requested. Mr. Speaker, we have Mrs. Fenwell from Governor from the State School, Mrs. Walter from St. Anne's Middle School, Mrs. Westphal from Bayside Comprehensive, Mrs. Valerie from Westside, Mr. Abetafi from the College, Mr. Barrado from Bayside, Mr. Clinton from St. Joseph's Middle, Ms. Cruz from Notre Dame, and Ms. Scott from Westside. That's for the primary and secondary working group. That's the initial working group. Then different subgroups will be established as a process developed. For example, there will be one working group specifically looking at the military aspect, which will have the early years foundation state coordinators and most of the teachers, so they all break out. And for the military working group, which is the introduction of more military provision, we have Ms. Mason, Mason from Notre Dame, Mrs. Berger from St. Joseph's Fair School, Mrs. Bahai from Bishop of Fair, Mrs. Montalupo from St. Joseph, and Mrs. Holmes from St. Bernard's Fair School, Mr. Speaker.
That covers the part of what the different aspects were for the two groups, or is there anything else that was touched upon in the other group? Because my question did that certain details of what these aspects were. The military was referred to primary and secondary, and then he moved on to the primary and military education. Were there any other methods that were looked upon by these entities?
Mr. Speaker, there have been two meetings of each of the two groups so far. There was a recent communication sent out to schools last month in relation to current structures and the impact on the current structures. With the heads were asked to discuss with their staff, and they were also curriculum urban audit sent to all teachers, inviting them to identify areas of the curriculum that they're confident in teaching, and by the way, we work training that we can deliver, because obviously we are shifting between primary and secondary, and we wanted to feel what the teachers themselves felt about their own personal position as well as the overall. And as I said, Mr. Speaker, there will now be different subgroups established to deal with each of the major items.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to touch upon first the security issue, which is at the moment being discussed by the Minister and his Ministry with the relevant authorities. Is this not something that is the case that the Minister has already undertaken and it's just final details that are being discussed, or is this something that is being discussed now after the plans are being produced?
speaker, this is an ongoing process. There has been initial contact at an early stage, but clearly, as we saw in the plans and the design, which is now almost complete in the sense that the stage two has been signed off and we're now completing stage three, which is the detail within classrooms and movement and so on. And that requires its own additional discussion. So this is an ongoing process which has gone quite far, but there is still a bit of a way to go. Absolutely.
So Mrs. Speaker, with regards to the parking in the neighborhood and the importance of ensuring that in particular pupils are not given the opportunity to use the parking beneath it as leverage to get out of exams and things like this. And the obviously being such a big school, 2,600 people that will be going into this school, having to undertake security threats of this nature in such a big school will obviously have a toll on the education and the timing and obviously the location of the school, which is in a corner which is obviously within the traffic flow from the cruise terminal. What has been the reaction and the advice given by those who advise the minister on this sort of security risk?
I think the Aeronautica has listed a large number of issues with which I don't, with a lot of which I don't agree. I do see hiding in the car park in order to avoid any burning. I mean, nowadays you can hide around the corner and into the Polish stadium.
Mr. Speaker, he's misunderstood. What I mean is there is heightened calls, obviously, from children who are suggesting that there could be risks underneath in the parking, which obviously would need investigating and could lead to stifling and bringing the school to a halt on many occasions.
You see, I would put it to the high step that the danger of a health call now with a parking site just this far away from an active classroom is much greater than it is in an underground park with a car park with a few flood protecting the school. I think of anything, the safety will be enhanced in that situation to what it is now. So I don't expect that concern.
Mr. Speaker, in the 2015 manifesto, the GSLP Liberal had a manifesto commitment to expand if necessary the St. Benedict or Dr. Hiraldi home onto the locations currently used by St. Martin. Is this still the case or are they deviating from that policy?
Mr. Speaker, I suppose that the Labour member is referring to that question on the site regarding expecting the winter. I explained the government's position in my answer and I have nothing further to add.
But could the minister confirm whether this is one of the possibilities or has this been disregarded?
Mr. Speaker, in my honesty, I have not yet been involved in that site. I expect to be involved as Minister for the Environment as I am in all allocation of land. But I have not had any involvement, so I cannot answer that question. No, was it specifically asked in the original question, so I was not in any way able to look into that information.
Mr. Speaker, three of that matter plans have been disclosed to the public in the John Maxwell's call. And the government has now finalised that stage of the preparation. Is the government now, made a decision on how it will actually populate the two secondary schools?
I think that this is a matter which is still being finalised. I have made this clear in my discussions, for example, in my recent discussions with the teaching population. Have made some comments on one of the possibilities, which is the alternation, so between receiving schools, that no decision has yet been made. This is part of the consultation process to which I have made numerous reference in the past.
Mr. Speaker, with reference to the question to the answer given to question number 2025 of 2018, I didn't quite get an answer, or I missed completely. The comment made in public by the Minister that if the 2019 deadline is not met, for some schools could, in particular, this was made in a press, after a press conference to do with the two secondary schools, that the transitioning could occur in between the academic year. Is that the case just for the two secondary schools, or is that the case for more than just the two secondary
schools? Mr. Speaker, I said I would not answer the question because it was a hypothetical one.
The reason that is my hypothetical question, because I recall seeing the minister in an interview on television stating the possibility, accepting the possibility that the that the school might move in the Easter Christmas, after the Easter Christmas vacation. Therefore, I think it's not hypothetical. He himself has included that possibility.
Yes, I think it is, Mr. Speaker, and I apologize if I have given the wrong impression. It's not that that is a hypothetical, but it's clearly not definite, and therefore, has to be hypothetical if the which school would end up in that situation, because I said that it was possible, but at the moment we still have those target dates. That hasn't changed, and therefore, I don't know which schools might like to have the opening or their move changed to another holiday period, and therefore I cannot answer that question, Mr. Speaker. But once we have that information, then I would be very happy to share that.
However, and without pointing to use any hypothetical questions, but given that the statement has been made, was that statement and the content of that statement made with the assurances and the backing of the teachers and the education department, in that it would be possible, if needs be, to transition schools in that 2 week period, whether it's Christmas or Easter?
We have to take what I said out of context. What I said was relative to the fact that we certainly cannot move a school in the middle of term time. Some schools would be easier to move than others. I will put it to you, Mr. Speaker, that a relatively small first school would be easier to move in a relatively small period of time than a large comprehensive school. And this is something that would have to be discussed with the school to see whether it is possible or not. It is a possibility in the future that we are not there yet.
Mr. Speaker, can you have some assurances from the Minister of Education that all is being done to be on top of the sensitivities associated with moving schools during a period which can be very close to exam time for students? Please.
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker.
So, speaking in relation to question number 229, did the Minister actually say that this is something that is currently being discussed with the fire department?
Mr. Speaker, there are two levels of discussion, and they include the fire department or the fire rescue service and specialist fire consultants. Where we are in this stage as to the detail as to whether the fire consultants have passed on their recommendation to the fire service, yes or not, I have not got that information, and that's certainly both are key elements in that discussion.
Mr. Speaker, but the government can confirm that a vaccination point and meeting point for people has been identified and agreed?
No, Mr. Speaker, this is part of the process. We cannot identify those points until we have the full development. Now we're going to stage two. Now we will know how the different classes will be populated, what kind of flow they will do. Now is the stage for that sort of thing. We cannot do it when it's just a plan with empty spaces in it. So this is an ongoing process. It's something that cannot be done before it's actually done.
Mr. Speaker, but would this not be something that would have been consulted and agreed on in the same way as the evacuation as a traffic impact on from the onset, from the moment go, before actually the
that first in mind, and I have to be careful as a speaker because I have brought a motion to this house where there will be ample time to debate, and I want to avoid the need to debate this now and debate it again. And that led to that at the proper time, as I mentioned, as a speaker. And that we are limited in developing to the space that we can provide, but within that, the design will inform whether that creation needs to have to be, what aspects needs to have to be. These are things that have to be developing continuously. And there will be iterations, and there will be changes as we improve before finally opening the school. And I hope, Mr. Speaker, that I won't have to answer these 10 questions every month or every other month, because we must expect that this is a live process. It's a dynamic, live process which does have to evolve and grow as the process proceeds.
Yes, Speaker, and in relation to the answer to the question 227 to do with the parking beneath the footprint, from my understanding, new Notre Dame is already being built, so those designs should already be more than agreed and firmed up in the same way as the work on a council for now, and I'm sure I can find the picture of it. The two secondary schools had already allocated a number of parking spaces. Is the minister able to provide the number of parking spaces that will be provided in these schools, given that obviously that information does exist?
The figure is not an area allocated to parking. The area is going to be allocated is under consideration. The number of spaces for perhaps venture, the number perhaps for purchase, the number for one or the other thing. All we have the number of electric charging points and costs, all these have a bearing on the configuration of the car parking, on the size of the parking bay, and therefore these are things that we have general figures, but not specific. And these again are being developed as we go along.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If I may keep the minister on the same question, 227, can the minister advise the House whether it is absolutely essential to the viability of the construction of the school that the available parking that's created is in fact sold to the private sector?
Sorry, could you repeat the question? I didn't catch it up.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker. Can the minister advise the House whether the viability of the entire school's project is dependent on the selling of these parking spaces underneath the school, or is it that the government has to have an option not to sell these parking spaces and retain them within the public use of the school itself? And this is a rider to the question. And is the minister aware of any school in Gibraltar that has to sell that a
personal footprint to a public sector? This question is quite bizarre. I will go back to the second part of my answer to that question. The number of spaces and the method of allocation is under consideration. It's because we're building these schools not because we are carrying it out to anybody, and we're building these schools because we are in dire need of them. And therefore, my answer to the other member is no. The number of spaces and the method of allocation is under consideration. And I think that the reference to having our part to the private sector is the word that I can offer.
And the particular minister may find it bizarre, but in fact, that is the reality. From the earlier information I've seen that the government is released from the project, it is the government's intention, and you can perhaps correct me, to actually sell. Or, as we were using the wrong word, rent out to the private sector the parking spaces. So, using the fact, giving away or selling an interest in the land in which our schools are built. And you can't deny that. Now, what I'd like to make in a minute is this still being considered by the government in Russia, i.e., if there's no cost to sell or rent these parking spaces in order to get repayment for schooling, or is it then absolutely committed or has no option but
to run for several sessions. I think he's going to stand up now and help our community. We're going to just focus on the style of the
game. I would like to tell the Honourable Member that there is no school use for parking. Pupils do not neither learn to park or drive in school. And therefore, this question is based on a suggestion which we don't have at the moment.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm talking to you, Mr. Reedy, again. Having had enough to what I'm doing now. And the point is, Mr. Speaker, is this. Is the government absolutely determined to rent or sell to the private sector areas underneath our schools, yes or no?
Speaker, the government is intent on making the best use of land in Gibraltar. As Joe Bassano said in his first budget speech, as Chief Minister of Gibraltar in 1988. The only thing that we have is our land and our people, and we must make more efficient use of both of those, and that is where the success of Gibraltar lies in the future. And they have a government plan, land use for the future, with regard to those two key views as to how we make Gibraltar more efficient.
So, three activities and treatment intervention that are even according to the past. That is the government's intention to spare areas underneath our schools to the private sector.
The Speaker, the government is confirming to the House that it has said publicly about the school project and reconfirming its commitment to the principles set out in 1988 by Joe Bassano in the first speech given 30 years ago now by the Chief Minister of Gibraltar on a budget that we make the most efficient use of our land, which is our principal resource, and our people, our second principal resource. And that means making efficient use of all the land that we have available, and that means sharing types of uses. It means sharing types of uses in the desire to be the most modern, most efficient, make the most modern and most efficient use of our land.
I think that when we talk about the best use of land 30 years ago, it might not mean the best use of land today, because today we're living in an era where there's huge insecurity in terms of security. And to think that in an area built up where there's going to be about 2,000 children, that land might be sold off to private buyers who could put their cars in, you know, one could imagine the worst about 2,000 children around in a highly densely populated area, for me, might not be the best use of land. So the government might be the best use of land for other reasons, but I'm thinking in terms of the best use of land for the children, and it's highly worrying.
Well, the government takes the view that what it said 30 years ago about the principle, not about the use of land, which is what the Honourable Lady has failed to address in what I assume was a question, is still as true today as it is, as it was 30 years ago, and it will be 30 years from now, because we will still be probably the smallest jurisdiction in Europe having to make the best possible use of land. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, the only thing you think that you can get away in her presumed question, with suggesting for one moment that the government will do something which endangers our children, she's not addressing the government that is sitting in front of us, she's addressing a government that must exist in her mind. The government is not just going to provide the best schools possible for our children. It's going to provide the most secure schools possible for our children. And I do detect, Mr. Speaker, that we may fall into the trap of going down the road that we went in respect of LNG, where it was suggested for the first part of the last election campaign that the government might do things which might put at risk any part of the geography of Gibraltar and the people of geography of Gibraltar. If we were not going to put at risk the people in the support territories of the north of Gibraltar, there is absolutely no chance whatsoever that we will do anything that will put at the slightest risk the children of Gibraltar in the new schools that we want to develop. And selling parking is not going to put anyone at risk. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, it may protect people more because there may not be on-street parking as close to the schools as they are today. Or is it that the Honourable Lady has not worked out that we are more likely to be at risk of somebody unknown to you parking alongside one of our schools today, then why do you sell parking to people who have to give you their details, who are only able to enter the car park with the number plate that is registered to a particular parking space? Even that obviously says that, Mr. Speaker. Of course it is, and the government would not do something that is unsafe. And Mr. Speaker, I have a huge time about the time to know that I deprecate any suggestion that any member of this government would for one moment countenance doing something that puts a child or children at risk. Her children, my children,
our children will go to that school, and we wouldn't for one moment do something that puts them at the very slightest of risk.
Honourable members are now debating on the question of whether parking should be allowed under the schools, and therefore we are moving on because they will have another opportunity to do so when the motion is tabled. Yes, the Honourable Member.
Mr. Speaker, would it be a convenient moment for you to allow me to refer to the schedule of giving an answer to question 220?
Yes.
It is relatively easy. That was from the 70 speakers, except for one point in each qualification. On the table, it shows that on the 29th and the 30th of January, due to inclement weather, the outdoor equipment was an outdoor facility, had to be cancelled. Just let you know that when it comes to St. Dan, it starts on the 29th of January and goes on for almost a month. So, inclement weather before it begins. My understanding, and the minister may need to work with, is that the facility available for me to use in St. Dan's is actually the gymnasium, and that's the inclement weather that we need for the gymnasium. If it fails due to repair to the gym.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I believe this refers to that event during one of the sessions or one of the times when we had inclement weather where scaffolding in the area collapsed. And therefore, as a precaution, the gym was closed because that was adjacent to it, and therefore it wasn't possible just in case there was a further problem which could have affected the roof of the gym. I believe, subject to confirmation, that is the reason for that.
Thank you, Speaker. That does clarify and make a lot more sense. The reason that I implied my assumption from previous answers that the only facility we need to invent is actually the gymnasium with no outdoor facility. I think that it wasn't in the past, so that is not nothing new, is it?
Mr. Speaker, I'm providing information that has been provided to me. There are other facilities that are settled have not been removed from use or they would have been in this system.
Question number 234, the Honourable Ed Plummer.
The Speaker, can the government provide details as to how the hot school lunches will be operated for each school, together with the additional estimated cost of preparing schools for this initiative and the estimated cost to parents?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, I answer this question together with question 235.
Question number 235, the Honourable Ed Plummer.
The Speaker, is the government considering implementing a pilot scheme in hot school lunches prior to September 2019?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, this is currently under consideration.
Mr. Speaker, just in relation to responses to those questions, will the government consider in respect of those families who are unable to meet any of the costs relating to hot school lunches, whether a government subsidy would be available for those families?
Mr. Speaker, I would be free to those families who would not be able to contribute, and that was I was clarifying with the Chief Minister, who I know said before I was Minister for Education, what my colleague was.
Question number 236, the Honourable Telephone.
The Speaker, can the government state how many pupils suffering from visual impairment dyslexia, attention deficit disorder, autism, Down syndrome, and other special needs at any time in school, giving a breakdown by school?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 237.
Question number 237, the Honourable Telephone.
The Speaker, can the government state these people suffering from visual impairment, dyslexia, attention deficit disorder, autism, Down syndrome, and other special needs attending government schools? What additional learning support is offered in each classroom by way of learning support assistance, including A, the number of pupils with special education needs in each class, B, the number of learning support assistants, and C, the school of pupil attendance?
information relating to question 236 can be found on the government website. And in relation to question 237, as I have explained in answer to previous questions, the location of such support will vary through the school year. The total number of LSAs is 102, which is 13 more than the last time I answered on this subject. I should, however, point out, Mr. Speaker, that I consider the use of the word offering to be totally inappropriate in this context. Perhaps, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member would care to refer to the language etiquette leaflet issued by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
To address that point, the reason why I phrased this question in this particular manner is because I took it from the former shadow minister for education when they were in opposition to ensure that there wasn't any leeway in making sure that my answer gets better. And my question was answered.
Question number 238, the
Honourable Mr. Speaker, can you provide a breakdown by age and gender of the pupils enrolled in first, middle, and secondary schools as of the 30th of September 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, providing details of each school and class?
Mr. Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Member to the Department of Government website where he will find information requested from 2012 onwards.
Question number 239, the Honourable Eric Lamas.
Mr. Speaker, some government states the amount spent by the Education Department from 1st of January 2012 to date in A, maintenance, B, minor works, and C, major works, being the breakdown by school, amount, date, contractor, and details of the work carried out.
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change, and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will do this question together with question 240.
Question number 240, the Honourable Eric Lamas.
The Speaker, the Honourable Member states 1st of January 2012 to date, what requests for A, maintenance, B, minor works, and C, major works remain unresolved, given a breakdown by school, date, report was made, nature of the each report.
Answer the Honourable Member for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, the information requested is available in online statistics in relation to question 239. Question 239. The contractors with very few exceptions are at his own rate. In relation to question 240, all requests have been addressed or are in process. There are a number of issues in many schools which are unresolved despite our best intentions, which is why we're embarked on a program of providing new schools and major refurbishments.
Is the government able to disclose which ones are in the process or unresolved?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the fact that we are having to new schools and carry out major refurbishments will clearly show which schools we are referring to.
Question number 241, the end.
Mr. Speaker, I've been able to log into the government website and statistics, and the question 230 does actually ask for details relating to each school and class. The information available online is simply specifically on each school and year. It doesn't have a breakdown for the class. This is something that the Honourable Minister can provide, please.
Mr. Speaker, as I said before, there will be a variation during the course of the year as some students move from class to class. I have said before that this is a hugely onerous task going back for that number of years I will need to consult and see whether that information is in fact available.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that school sizes can vary throughout the year, but the question actually goes say as of the 30th of September, the 30th of September 2017, for example. Is this something that the government cannot look at?
Yes, I did. I said that I will see what information I can accept. But as I said, it's an onerous task. If you want to remember, it's very much what the average school class has in for him, maybe that's what he's after. But I will certainly endeavor to obtain this information.
Mr. Speaker, simply like to speak to you as well, but would it be possible to say the same question at the next meeting in order to give ample time to the Minister and his department to provide an answer for this question?
If you think we wanted to be on the record of answer, then yes. But otherwise, the Minister could undertake to write to you. But if you wanted to be on the record, I would allow it.
In the answer, and the number we note is from 2012 onwards, not 2011.
Okay.
Question number 241, the
Albert Alexander. The Speaker, the government intends to introduce new registration for pupils attending secondary school as from September 2019.
Question for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, the State Island website currently conducts their registration sessions in an electronic format and will continue to do so in September
2019.
Question number 242, the Honourable T.M. Hammond. The Speaker, some government states when we did get leases up for renewal and whether the government is intending to impose any environmental restrictions such as a requirement for short supply power and restrictions in the hours of operation where noise is a problem under the terms of any new lease.
The
Speaker, the Big Deck lease is up for renewal. Details of discussions are confidential. However, the government has engaged with Big Deck in order to reduce their environmental impact quite independently of any renewal discussion.
Would the Minister not agree that discussions reference, and I understand the discussions themselves are confidential, but this would represent an opportunity to perhaps impose environmental restrictions, such as those regarding noise and certainly those regarding emission from your document?
Mr. Speaker, as I say, we are discussing quite independently of any renewal. I think the need to improve the environmental impact of every single activity in the water is something that we aspire to and need not be linked to anything else. So that is my belief within my department, and I will continue to pursue that.
So, can I make the concern on whether the discussions that have taken place outside of those discussions that have taken place for the recent years are referenced the provision of short supply power to reduce emissions and the management of noise, particularly at night, that is coming from the document?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that would require another question to be led. I can tell you that I am not leading on the discussions on this renewal. I am leading on discussions of environmental improvement and some of the things that our member has mentioned as we stated in the press release not too long ago are part of these discussions, but I'm not linking one to the other necessarily.
So I think that the Minister is leading on the other discussions reference the environment, so hopefully he can therefore at least make clear whether yes, speaking environmental improvement, whether those two particular provisions could also be of interest in the area of making these decisions, are part of the agenda, and whether he can inform us how progress is, how those talks are proceeding, how those discussions are proceeding, and whether he
areas that we are actively discussing, that we have no clear with them, but it's not coming here to defend or otherwise the performance of Jibdo, just to say that we are engaged with them and we are looking forward to further improvement.
One last question, if I may, Mr. Speaker. As these particular discussions are not related to the rooms, can the Minister have any idea when those discussions may be complete and perhaps the public announcement made?
The discussions are ongoing, and there could be new issues arising, and there is a regular contact with Tibet, both from my ministry and from the environmental agency. So this is an ongoing thing. It's not one in which there is a particular time for.
I should say this is the last question, Mr. Speaker, but actually the Minister's response to further question. So if I'm asked by a resident of the area that I frequently am, whether I've asked questions of what progress there is, my response at the moment seems to me can only be, well, going to talk to Good Doc, but on these particular issues of which you are particularly interested, the government can't explain to me or describe to me any detail as to what progress or as to when something may be achieved in respect to those issues.
It would not surprise any member, anybody in this house, that the government, and certainly in representation of the government, my ministry and I, are pursuing these and many other issues very strongly in order to improve the situation, not just in Jibdo, but everywhere else in the world. And so anybody who goes to the honourable member can certainly be referred to me and to the ministry, and I would be very glad to talk to them and engage with them and tell them what we're doing, and can be reassured that we're doing everything in our power to improve the environmental performance of every operation in the world.
Question number 243, the Albert Electrons.
Mr. Speaker, follows the question 607 of 2017, can the government provide an updated schedule of payments made to include Commonwealth Park and the many developments and the names of the entities that payments have been made to?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by all members in the schedule that I have handed over, let me say, Mr. Speaker, that I bring the case of question 607 of 2017, I have not identified the different entities. Some of them are in competition with each other, and therefore, as I said at the time, without the specific agreement, I think it would be unfair to mention them by name across to the House.
Question number 244, the Honourable Electronics.
The Speaker, those agreements intend to open for tender the maintenance of planted areas around the water currently carried out through contract.
And for the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government is considering this.
Question number 245, the Honourable Eric Rammer.
Mr. Speaker, since April 2017, can the government state what the cost of clearing, maintaining, and enhancing of the North Front Cemetery together with the name of the contractors and trustees?
And for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the tender was awarded to Greenmark in August 2017. For a period of 2 years up to July 2019 at a yearly sum of £103,228.
And this is 244.
So when the minister intends to open for tender the food contract, is there a timeline that he's thinking of at this point in time?
Mr. Speaker, we are considering the way in which this could be done, and in relation to how the welfare may be divided up in sectors or in types of work that needs to be done. So it's currently an issue that is being considered, but I cannot give any more information at this stage.
Question number 246, the Honourable Alan Prince.
Can we then please advise the date of the GHA board meeting in which the executive decision to remove quarterly financial reports from the public part of GHA board meetings is agreed to by the GHA board?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I would ask this question to go to this question 247
to 249. Question number 247, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain why a report from the Director of Finance and Procurement is no longer a standing agenda item for GHA board meetings, even of health and private, and the absence of this report, how does the board monitor the financial performance and resource allocation of GHA?
Question number 248, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, has the government established a national debenture committee in accordance with 2015 National Debenture Vision and Strategy for Gibraltar?
Question number 249, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, will the Minister for Health still stand by his personal commitment given to taxpayers in his budget speech on the 27th of June 2017? That, and I quote, in my first year as Minister for Health, the GHA will come within budget, end quote.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the decision to remove the quarterly financial report from the public part of the GHA board meeting was taken by the CEO and his executive team prior to the GHA board meeting of the 21st of September 2016. The board report from the GHA Director of Finance and Procurement is now discussed in the internal session of the GHA board. The report may contain commercially sensitive information, and is taken with the public may hinder the GHA's ability to obtain the best value for money for taxpayers. The financial performance and resource allocation is reviewed and discuss among board members of each GHA board meeting. The government of Gibraltar publishes the annual GHA accounts at the end of the financial year, together with the estimate for the next financial year. The government is in the process of deciding on the individual who will form part of the National Dementia Committee. I can personally attest, Mr. Speaker, that in the last year, my team of the GHA and I have made important strides in improving financial control and accountability, the full details of which I will be delighted to set out at this year's budget debate.
I'm grateful to Mr. Speaker's answer. I don't quite catch the answer to question 247. There is no report on the agenda from the Director of Finance and Procurement. I fail to see how the GHA board can discuss financial information. There is no such report to be had, even in Canada. Could be useful to clarify that point.
Minister, Mr. Speaker, I have just risen for my first reply, so I will try not to get contentious in my first reply to a supplementary question. The answer is in the original answer that I gave to the Honourable Gentleman, which is that the report is discussed in the in-camera part of the GHA board meeting. Therefore, we will not have part of that agenda because it is in-camera, but it is discussed in the in-camera aspect of the board meeting. I fully understood what he said, but he still doesn't understand my point. And my point is this. Every week we look at, for example, the agenda from the 2015 CSA book, held on the 1st of July 2015, we're actually seeing as a report, 6.3, as a report of the finance and the students that in camera. But again, I don't see that in the agenda for current business. Again, I ask the minister, does he want the people to present the report to the DOJ? And if so, why isn't this a standard agenda item?
Mr. Speaker, for the very reason I told him that it is discussing the in-camera section, the report is presented in the in-camera section, and it is discussed by board members in the in-camera section. As I told him as well, the decision not to include it as part of the public aspect of the board discussion is for the reasons that I gave him here. And there's no more to add other than to say that the discussion is had by the board members. But the in-camera, but in the in-camera part of the DHK board.
May I suggest to the minister may wish to consider to include as an agenda item for my peace of mind, at least my republic, that the board are considering is that they haven't listed on the agenda as the person who left the final procurement, that in-camera, but we do at least know the board is discussing it rather than. The minister has come to the House and said, yes, of course, the board is discussing it. But it's not on the agenda, Mr. Speaker. So could it perhaps be kind enough to ensure that it is on the agenda in future, so that for the benefit of those who are not privy to the in-camera session, that we do know that at least some members are being presented? And furthermore, as we do know now, the director, or medical director, doesn't give an overview of the same way the chief executive used to in his report. Or at least some context of the DOJ board is considering these matters formally as the agenda would indicate.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think that the Honourable Gentleman has understood my reply. I have told them that the report is discussed, that it is discussing the in-camera section of the DOJ board. So I hope that he has now. He has asked you to consider whether. You will go back and put it on the outside of the camera over there with the note that it is in camera.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, everybody knows me, but everybody
has now asked
me. Yes, but he finishes off by saying that the medical director now does not discuss it in the way that it used to. And I'm telling you that it is being discussed in the way that it used to, except that we don't have the agenda item on the open part of the DOJ board. So, to be clear, the report is discussed in the in camera section of the. Of the DHA board meeting, Mr. Speaker.
The Prime Minister being not to label the point any further, will the Minister undertake in future to at least include the agenda item, as I suggest, with the word income and that's it, we know that it is on the agenda as a standing item, as all the others are. And I know he's saying the report is fine, I think the word is, but can we have it on the agenda?
Mr. Speaker, it really is quite something. When you have the task opposite to when my honourable predecessor started the process of having open DHA board meetings, we were heavily criticised for having DHA board meetings in the open. And at the time, the honourable lady who represented the party of the DHD was adamant that to have an open process and have DHA board meetings in open was not perhaps the best way to conduct DHA business. And now we have a situation that 6 or 5 years later, asking us to have an item on the agenda in respect of the in-camera part. The in-camera part of the DHA board meeting is not placed on the open agenda of the DHA board meeting because it is discussed in the private part of the DHA board meeting. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, it would be a license to add an agenda item in the open part of the DHA board meeting on a matter that is discussed in the in-camera DHA board meeting. Because if I were to apply to follow his logic, then I would have to list in the DHA open board meeting every single item discussed in the in-camera part of the DHA board meeting. So, Mr. Speaker,
I will not accede to his suggestion. Mr. Speaker, such a stupid idea is Peter Sutton actually did it. And again, I refer him back to the November the 1st of July 2015. Mr. Speaker, one, chief executive, two, director of public health, three, report, director of financial security, that's all I'm asking for, nothing complicated. His predecessor did it. If you say, look, there are things in camera, why can't the agenda? I don't know what else is being discussed in camera. And this is practically critical. We're not talking about, you know, have the entrance area been set this month or not in camera. This is critical. He has a budget over £100 million. We want to know to discuss regularly all the in camera funds. If predecessor did it, why can't he?
We don't realize that we live in linear time, and there is something called the reflection of time. And the agenda item of which we speak in 2015, subsequent to that point in time, there is a decision by the CEO of, in 2016, not to have this enforced discussed on the agenda of the open GHA board. And therefore, it makes no sense to me, as a current GHA chairman, to place an item of this discussion in the internal section of the GHA board, in the open section of the GHA board, because trying to be consistent on a kind of emergency that we need to proceed to, if I were to decide for this particular item to add it to the open board meeting agenda, I would feel as I would also have to add all of the items that we list in the agenda for the private part of the GHA board meeting. So, no need to speak it. For the third or the fourth time, I will not accede to adding an item in the agenda of the GHA open board meeting for discussion in the in-camera section of the board meeting, Mr. Speaker.
I've insisted for the third or fourth time that that remains the position. I am afraid that we are going to move on to something else.
Mr. Speaker, I know he's very, very interesting point. Is there an effective suggestion to have that there are two agendas for the GHA board, one which is actually published on the website, and another one which is private? Is that true?
Mr. Speaker, there are different pieces of addiction. There is an in-camera GHA board meeting. Therefore, there is the public part, which the GHA was against, in 2012, and the in-camera having always been part of the process. The elderly gentleman grants the house with his couples every time they have the open board meeting, they're delighted to have him. And at the conclusion of that meeting, they say thank you to the elderly gentleman and any other members of the press, and we excuse them because we told them we will now discuss the in-camera part of the GHA board meeting, and therefore it is a surprise to me that he should be surprised that there is a part of the GHA board meeting that is not publicly exposed, given that it is held in camera, which is behind closed doors. And let me also tell the honourable gentleman that I'm also delighted that it's supposed to be from the Devoted Chronicle, because it was the Devoted Chronicle that was asking the questions to me. So maybe perhaps they should be referring to the Devoted Chronicle. What questions are they going to be asking me?
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for the Department of Health for having professed this year. And of course, Mr. Speaker, if the Minister had had grace after his presence in that meeting and the meeting before, which was both absent, we might have been the benefit of wisdom in those board meetings, camera or not in camera. So, Mr. Speaker, we move on, as we suggested. The National Defence Division Strategy for Gibraltar 2015, we're now in 2018. Can I ask the Minister what is taking so long in considering the constituent members of this committee and when will we hope to make a decision? Mr. Speaker, at least I would rather the honourable gentleman agree that the government is very well endowed with the benefit of wisdom. The reason why I do not attend the first GHA board meeting to which I referred is because I am afraid I was in Parliament. And as much as I try to expand my skill set, by location, not yet a gift that I have to say. However, I do ask for that gift increasingly given the details that I described. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, in respect of the question you asked about the National Dementia Strategy, it is right that we haven't yet set the committee number for that particular body. And the reason is because, as the elder gentleman knows, the government has opened the Belarista Day Centre inside and also added a floor to go on to home. And it was the considered right of clinicians and of service groups and of users that it was very important to have those sites and those facilities rolled out and then to continue with the work of the National Dementia Strategy. I'm pleased to inform you that the National Dementia Strategy has almost finished its revision. It has to be updated given the addition of the excellent facilities that have been rolled out. And there has been a meeting now, I think, 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago between the person who's the commission that is updating the National Dementia Strategy with GAD and with Elderly Residential Service to discuss the different parts of the National Dementia Strategy, including who are the persons who should be nominated to sit on the National Dementia Strategy Committee. So we are hopeful to be able to announce the names of the persons who will sit in that committee very, very soon.
I'm grateful to the Minister for Vance from the National Dementia Committee. I look forward to his announcement in due course. Coming to question 249, and I just make a very simple yes or no answer from the Minister, although I may be just wishful thinking on my part. Does the Minister stand by his statement that the GSA will come within budget, yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, it was wonderful how I give answers to the Honourable Gentleman, and he asked me questions again to answers which I have already given.
But Mr. Speaker, obviously my brain obviously is not functioning well with these, but I definitely did not hear a simple answer to the question. He said he would give some kind of update, etc., etc. That wasn't my question, Mr. Speaker. My question was, does he stand by the statement, yes or no? Will it come within budget, yes or no?
Well, I've already told him, Mr. Speaker, that I would be delighted to discuss all of that at the budget session.
Mr. Speaker, I get a grateful for your guidance from this, but I don't think we're under any rules regarding the future budget in terms of discussing an outcome since we haven't had the estimates book yet. So, again, very simple question. I don't want to discuss the budget term. I'd like to know now, today, is this full confidence about statements, yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, thankfully for him, and I think for the fact, I do not regulate my life depending on his wishes or his whims. I have already given him the answer to my question, which is that I will be delighted to discuss it during the course of the budget debate. He does not like it, Mr. Speaker, so be it.
Mr. Speaker,
the fact of the matter is that it is clear to me, in fact, that makes it clear to me that you're not going to get an answer to that specific question. And because we aren't going to get an answer to that specific question, we are moving on to the next. Thank you. I'm not going to get an answer to that question.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not allowed to ask questions of the government and expect an answer. That's all right.
The government is not obliged to answer any specific question. If they don't want to answer it, they don't have to. It's a matter to them, ultimately. It's not a matter for the rules. I am not the arbiter after the adequacy of the government's answer to an opposition question. So much.
Mr. Speaker, may I ask the Honourable Minister a second? Obviously, you may have answered this, but in my old age, and I can't recall exactly whether he's answered this particular point. But did he not agree with you that in circumstances where the GHO, the cost of running the GHO, has more than doubled since 2011, that in circumstances where the GHO is costing, or health expenditure is costing, roughly about, it was last year, about £10 million per month, that's £120 million nearly a year,
the government is now introducing efficiency measures, presumably, to deal with a situation where we have, in some areas, runaway expenditure on the GHO. And indeed, in circumstances where we now have, or Gibraltar is facing Brexit, where the government is going to have to reposition areas of our economy in relation to that, and presumably that. That could have a knock-on effect as well on revenue. That it is in those circumstances imperative that we have greater transparency, not less transparency. And can the minister explain to me why the government is moving to less transparency at this particular point in time? Instead of the older gentleman's prophecies, his questions are longer than that is the longer than the longer, which I recommend that he listens to. It is not that the government is moving to less transparency as a whole. We have told the Honourable Mr. Clayton that the finances of the GHO will be discussed at that time. All of the finances and all of the subjects will be discussed then. They can ask as many questions as they like during the course of the budget debate and, of course, during the course of the I do not know whether I have the honourable gentleman corrected, but the GHO's budget has not doubled since the time that the GST, the cost of the GHO, I think I'm looking at the last year of the GST, which was 2001-2012, and if I call correctly, it has been £89 million, or something along those lines, and the cost last year was £119 million. So we're nowhere near doubling the cost of the GHO. I had a look at the point that they have in mind the budget in 2011. Anyway, I'll stand to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I'll go back to that. But the point is, Mr. Speaker, that the government takes a decision, and the decision in this case is to hold in camera, back in 2016, what had previously been discussed openly, and therefore was subject to public scrutiny, was subject to comment by members of the public, by members of the press, and indeed by the House on a monthly basis those meetings took place in public. And it is for the government to justify why it goes from a position of transparency, in other words, open meetings, to a position where that aspect is now being discussed in camera. I just don't have it clear in my mind why it is at this particular juncture, where I'm taking all those factors that I outlined in my previous question, why it is that the government is moving towards less transparency in this particular instance. Mr. Speaker, as I said, I wasn't privy to the discussion that took place between the CEO of the GHO at the time and the executive team. But I have to tell you that even without being privy to those discussions, if I had been the chairman of the GHO in 2012, I would never have placed the finances of the GHO for discussion in a public meeting during the course of the year, not just because of the reason that I gave this out, which is that if you have this open discussion about and so on, it could very much impact on the ability of the GHO to be able to enter into any subsequent negotiations following a tender, but also because we very well finances are not yet reconciled until after the financial year. So to provide any figure at any point in the course of the financial year, which is subject to reconciliation and correction and audit, to me, would have been a no-go area in the first place, mostly for that particular reason. That's the only case, Mr. Speaker, whereas the honourable gentleman now espouses a philosophy of having the GHO board meetings in the open. He has to remember that when he sat with the honourable lady that no longer sits next to him, you have talked about the honourable lady this afternoon on three separate occasions, haven't you? He's to her. On three separate occasions, the people member of the opposition are not bound. What the honourable lady that we are referring to sits here in the House, whatever question, whatever policy position she was taking, you apologize in the verbiage. You don't need to apologize for us on this side of the house. We entirely accept that you believe you're dealing with somebody else. And the only point I wanted to make on behalf of the whole government was that we thought it was valid to make the political point, and I'm grateful for your indication. I find that we're going to look into a flux of time, but Mr. Speaker, one thing for time to pass, it's quite another for people to change their position. The other lady to the right has passed in time and in philosophy and politics from the labels of the GOP. The honourable gentleman to the left also, but honourable members in the middle are stuck with being members of the Gibraltar Social Democrats. If anybody says that the quantity of politics of that party, all they need to do is to leave the Gibraltar Social Democrats, and then they will be free to make their modern new friends. But otherwise, they're rendered with the record. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to give you work with an opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Yes,
yes. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We all take position. We spent 10 years calling you the black veil of Gibraltar politics, and I didn't receive an invitation to meet Nick Steiner.
The last thing I wanted was family conflict on the skyway. The last thing for both of you was Doug Vader and Luke Skywalker in the same space with Lady Blackstone. Was that the only thing that concerned me?
Yes, thank you very much. There's the minister.
This is not an issue just simply about rule numbers. Because, of course, look, I'll give the minister an example. One of the most interesting pieces of information that during my time in opposition I derived from reports based on the minutes of these meetings on the finances was the fact that in 2012, the GSA board discussed that there was a problem with the procurement side, and that was causing significant concern to the GSA board. Right? Now, that was a matter that they then brought to this house, and I asked supplementary questions. It's a matter of public interest. If the board of the GSA thinks that there is an issue with public procurement within the GHA. Efficiency, for example, that the government is also now undertaking in relation to the GHA. That's not a topic that involves numbers, but it involves also labour issues. These are all matters of public interest. Not all. If the government closes the shackles by hiding off all that aspect in camera, and doesn't allow the public to find the opposition on the press to properly scrutinize that aspect, then of course that I think is not in the best interest of democracy. And I'm just asking the government to explain that. And it's not just that, it's my second entry, but it's not just simply about doing on this. I have already explained that even if I had been privy to the conversations between the former CEO of the GHA in discussing the reasons why to remove the report from the public part, I would have definitely agreed with that decision for the reasons that I've already enumerated. Firstly, I've not considered how the GHA's position to discuss financials when those financials could impact on the ability of the GHA to be able to negotiate best value for money on a particular contract, but not think that it's wise to write numbers in the course of a public debate before those numbers are reconciled and before they're checked. I think it actually causes more harm than good, and therefore, as I said, even though I was not the chairman of the GHA at the time, I stand by the decision to move that discussion and of the GHA agenda to the income recession.
Question number 250, the honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker,
following question number W126 of 2017, can the government please provide details of the number of inpatients being treated at foreign hospitals and medical establishments as at January 2017 and 2018, providing a breakdown of the same? The government has already provided the breakdown for previous years.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
I will answer this question together with questions 251 to 258.
Question number 251, the Honourable D.A. Simpson. Can you please update the answer provided to question W127 of 2017 and provide details of the monthly number of inpatients being treated in Grand Hospital in Spain for 8 months from August 2017? Question number 252, the Honourable D.A. Simpson. As of the 31st of December 2017, how many individuals were working in the DHA, the care agency, and the ERS? The recruitment consultant, and how many were employed directly by those organizations?
Question number 253, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
How many individuals were employed directly by the DHA, the care agency, and the elderly residential services as at the 31st of December 2015, and were working within those organizations that employed the recruitment consultant setting up the nationality?
Question number 254, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
I'm assuming that any minister please provide a schedule setting out the number of nurses working in the care agency and elderly residential services, stating whether those nurses are employed directly by the care agency and elderly residential services in permanent and pensionable terms, a six-term contract for full recruitment consultants together with their nationality.
Question number 255, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister please provide a schedule setting out the number of nurses working in each department of symbolic hospitals, also stating whether those nurses are employed directly by the DHA on permanent and pensionable terms and fixed on contract for full recruitment consultants together with their nationality?
Question number 256, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister provide a schedule showing the length of contracts of all doctors employed at the Bonus Hospital, so in the areas in which they practice, their nationality and the rates they started.
Question number 257, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, how much has the DHA or the government on its behalf paid out in respect of claims made against the DHA in respect of the last 2 years, providing a breakdown on a case by case basis?
Question number 258, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Can the government please provide details of the average waiting time for non-urgent referrals from the primary care centre to consultants or doctors at the hospital since March 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, we have been unable to extract data providing details of the number of ill cases being treated by hospitals and medical establishments as of January 17, 18, identifying each hospital and medical establishment. Furthermore, we inform the House with respect to question, written question 126-2017 that the header of the table reading number of ill patients being treated at our hospitals should have read number of patients referred. The table contains the number of patients referred to foreign hospitals who were treated as outpatients and inpatients. That shows the total number of referrals. Now, the motion for January 2017 and January 2018 is as follows. January 2017, number of patients referred, 355. January 2018, number of patients referred, 236. And I hand over to the Honourable Gentleman in Sydney, identifying each hospital and medical establishment as of January 2017 and January 2018. This is also the breakdown for the number of patients treated at general hospitals since August of last year is as follows. August 17, 45. September 17, 67, October 17, 64, November 17, 62, December 17, 14, January 18, 5, February 18, 2. As of the 31st of December 2017, there were 1,164 individuals working within the GHA, of which 62 were employed by a labour supply agency, and 1,102 who who were employed directly by the GHL. As of the 31st of December 2017, there were 282 individuals working within the Cal Agency, of which 149 were employed by a Labour Supply Agency, and 232 were employed directly by the Cal Agency. As of the 31st of December 2017, there were 422 individuals working within the EAS, of which 127 were employed by a Labour Supply Agency, and 315 were employed directly. Since there were individuals who were employed by the GHA, the care agency, and elderly residential services, as of the 31st of December 2015, are employed by Labour Supply Agency. There are 7 nurses working in the care agency, of which 3 are in fixed-term contract and 4 are on indefinite contract. Of the 7 nurses, 5 are British and 2 are of Spanish nationality. There are 327 nurses working in the ERS, of which 237 are on indefinite contract, 1 is permanent and pensionable, and 89 are from Labour Supply Agency. Of the 327 nurses, 135 are British, 102 are Spanish, and 1 is of Polish nationality. We do not hold information of the nationalities of the nurses working through a Labour Supply Agency. Mr. Speaker, there are 355 nurses working at St. Bernard Hospital, of which 106 are in permanent and pensionable contracts, 181 are on indefinite contracts, 31 are in fixed-term contracts, and 37 are through Labour Supply Agencies. Of the 355 nurses, 230 are British, 80 are Spanish, 2 are Polish, 1 is Irish, 1 is French, 1 is Swedish, 1 is Portuguese, 1 is Romanian, and 1 is of German nationality. We do not hold information on the nationalities of the nurses working through a Labour Supply Agency. The 355 nurses are working in the following departments: A&D 34, Blood Department 4, Breast Palliative Care 3, Captain Murchison Ward 36, Critical Care Unit 39, Day Infusion 2, Day Surgery 12, Dialysis 6, Deadly Tumor Ward 33, Infection Control 2, John Ward 38, Maternity Ward 27, Medical Investigation Unit 22, Oncology Chemotherapy 1, Operating Theatre 17, Ophthalmic 7, Pre-Assessment Clinic 3, Rainbow Ward 18, Relief Cover 7, CFSD 10, Victoria Ward 34. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman. A schedule showing the length of contract for all doctors employed at St. Bernard's Hospital, showing the age and each of those doctors, their nationality, and date they have been tested. Mr. Speaker, the GHO or the government on its behalf has paid out in respect of claims made against it in respect of the last 2 financial years £400,000, breaking into 8 payments of £50,000 each. Speaker, for the second completion, I provide to the Honourable Gentleman the average waiting time for urgent and non-urgent referrals. Waiting time for referrals from primary care to some very practical cost facilities is as follows. General physician, average waiting time in March last year, 6 to 8 weeks. Average waiting time in February this year, 4 to 8 weeks. Average waiting time for urgent referrals, 1 week. General surgery, average waiting time for March last year, 12 weeks. Average waiting time for surgery this year, 4 weeks. Average waiting time for urgent referrals, 1 to 2 weeks. Gynecology, average waiting time for March 2017, 16 to 20 weeks. Average waiting time this year, 3 weeks. Average waiting time for urgent referrals, 2 weeks. Orthopedic consultant, Mr. Speaker, I need to inform the House that with respect to this part, I stated the average for orthopedics was 8 to 20 weeks, when in fact the average waiting time was 52 to 50 weeks. My apologies. The average waiting time for February this year is 42 weeks, and the average waiting time for urgent referrals 1 week. In respect of EMS and sports consultant, average waiting time in March last year, 5 to 10 weeks. Average waiting time for February this year, 48 weeks. Average waiting time for urgent referrals February this year, 1 week. Pediatrician, average waiting time for routine referrals in March last year, 8 to 12 weeks. Average waiting time originally followed in February this year, 6 weeks. Arbitration time for arbitration files to pediatrics, there is no waiting time, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, we need a note to, for the honourable gentleman, not to surrender the advantage that he has of having the written answer there and giving it to me before I start with my supplementaries. Will you be so kind as to give me the answer after the session finishes so that I can take that? Thank you. I'm very grateful to you. Well, just dealing with the recruitment consultant, as I understand it, there are 149 employees employed within the care agency, two recruitment consultants, out of a total workforce in the care agency of 382. That means that there is about 39% of people within the care agency are effectively working via recruitment consultants. Then in relation to elderly residential services, I think the figure that the Honourable Gentleman gave me, and the people who consented, is 127 employed by recruitment consultants out of a total workforce of 422, the percentage there is 30%. Now, does the Honourable Gentleman agree with me in the first instance that we are dealing with significantly high percentages of workers working within these two sectors employed to recruitment consultants? No, Mr. Speaker, I do not agree with him for the simple reason that I have explained in the past every time he's asked in the House. I know that he said in a recent video, which was shared with me, which they would, of course, have to grab a little podcast when they were in government, that I welcome the video. And he said in the video that we never answer the questions in respect of how many people are employed by Labour Society. Let me tell you, that is not correct. We have gone back to Hansard, and I have answered that question every single time he's asked me that particular question. I have answered that particular question 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. 15 times he's asked me, and 15 times got the answer. I think that on the next occasion that we make a video, which I would have called a grab little podcast, at least time for decency to rectify the incorrect statements that he attributed and the modifiers that he attributed to me in that respect. The reason I don't agree with him, Mr. Speaker, is for the reason I've explained to him in the past on those 15 occasions. The care agency provides domiciliary care. As you know, the domiciliary care budget has gone from £600,000 for the Labour and government to £2.6 million now. The number of persons receiving domiciliary care has increased to, if I recall correctly, over, if I have the exact figure, in the last calendar year, there were 478 persons receiving domiciliary care. So these are 478 persons from the community which receive domiciliary care by carers. And therefore, it has represented a huge increase in the number of people who are able to receive care, continuing to live in the houses, which I'm sure that we can both agree is in fact a very good thing. Because by providing carers at home and within the community, we avoid the possibility that as a result of the lack of care, they may end up in hospital, where we only have people who require medical and clinical care rather than other types of care. As a result, care workers in the care agency amounts to 135. Those carers are the ones that are employed through the labour supply agencies. We did not have that facility of having labour supply agencies providing that care. Then what he's asking us is to directly employ 135 persons. If you were to do that, the bill to the taxpayer, in order to provide what I think is an excellent and beneficial service to the community, will not be 2.5 million. It would be a lot more. And I think for the reasons that he alluded himself earlier, that we have to provide services in a sustainable way, we are persuaded that providing services through labour supply agencies is the correct one to take. We provide the care that persons need in the community, and we also take care of taxpayers' money. Well,
thank you very much to the Minister for that answer. Indeed, I have asked questions in relation to how many people have been employed through recruitment consultants and recruitment consultants generally on a number of occasions, because it is a matter that is of concern to Her Majesty's opposition, and it is a matter that is of concern to the people that are employed through recruitment consultants. Indeed, it is of concern to those service users who want to see continuity of service. And therefore, it's a concern, I would suggest to the Honourable Member, all around. It does appear that concern is justified because these are very, very high numbers. 9% in the care agency, 30% in the elderly residential services. Mr. Speaker, you may have provided me with these figures in the past, but in fact, I am still waiting for an answer to a question that I read last time round, which was a question about how many people are employed in recruitment consultants in the government generally, and in public authorities generally. I am still waiting for the answer. That answer has not been provided. I don't know whether that answer will be provided at the business discussion. But I don't agree with the characterisation that the government provides the answers to the question. The only minister, in fairness to him, may provide answers to questions that I've asked in relation to this. But other members of his government don't, and it's not my fault if the government is politically schizophrenic in that regard. Mr. Speaker, don't you disagree with me? What is the government put in place in order to ensure that there is continuity of service to service users and that service users do not suffer as a consequence of having people employed through recruitment consultants that by their very nature is going to be short-term employment? Because if the minister says it's not short-term employment, then that raises other issues in relation to the exploitation of workers who are being placed in these positions.
Mr. Speaker, is there any error in the mouth of the Honourable Gentleman to call this government politically schizophrenic when we had a PDP leader of the opposition, a Labour party that merged with the GST, and therefore let us not talk about schizophrenia, Mr. Speaker, because the party opposite has given us much in the subject, and indeed it was an entire conference of psychologists to examine the schizophrenia that is prevalent in that particular party. I know the Honourable Gentleman's concern in respect of that continuity of care. And it's not a point that I wish to be confrontational with and end, because I think we're all agreed that if we can provide continuity of care to persons who are in our trust, we should. But of course, the Honourable Gentleman, in my view, misses the obvious point. Even if the government were to triple the budget for domiciliary care from 3.5 million to 6 million, because we directly employ persons by any of the agencies on which they're asking questions, people still get sick, they go on leave, they have other commitments, so you would never have a choice, never, where there will only be one person providing a continuity of care. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, it happened all over my responsibility, including, of course, in the DHA. I have to make the point at times that nurses, for instance, do not work directly or just for a ward. They work for the GHA. The GHA also encompasses the ERS, and therefore, persons employed by the GHA or the ERS may have to provide their services in other parts of my responsibilities. But do we try to ensure continuity of care? It is the policy of the government that we try to ensure it. That is the directive that is issued to the care provider. And they try to do so insofar as is possible, but the point I'm trying to maintain is this. If you want to migrate all of the persons who work as labour, provided rather, to labour recruitment supply firms, and they were to be called over to the GHA, the same issues would arise whether they're directly employed or not. In other words, the form of employment in no way changes the issues that arise in terms of continuity of care. And therefore, given that that is the case, there is no reason why we would change a demonstrably excellent
arrangements with labor supply firms who are able to provide care to the persons in our community who deserve it and who, of course, provide it at what we think are eminently reasonable prices that always ensure the best interest of our community.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that the preamble to his answer provokes a preamble for me, and that is that we might as well all go to joint councillors because they think we are the regular move of the Liberal contingent. has not always been abiding with the just two side of the contingent, and that indeed fighting elections against it in 1992 and 1996. But Mr. Speaker, there is an important distinction. I understand that you're always going to need within any organization supply workers. That's undoubtedly the case. It happens in the private sector, it happens in the public sector. But what we are dealing with is a significant amount of labor in recruitment consulting. I mean, 39%. And what I want to know is what the government is doing to ensure that that does not lead to any prejudice in the service that is provided to service users. Because by the very nature of recruitment consultants, you are much more likely to have a higher turnover of staff than if they were employed in a different way. And I have more supplementaries in relation to this one. They're not only going to give me the answer, I'm moving.
The Honourable Gentleman is full of questions to which I've already given answers to. And when I arose, it wasn't in preamble to an answer, it was my answer. I have told him on every single occasion he's asked me, and I've told him he's asked me on 15 separate occasions, that the government is entirely satisfied with the services that are being provided to the labour supply company. I wish the Honourable Gentleman would stop calling it a recruitment agency. They're not recruitment agencies, they're labour supply companies. Of course, the care agency, the GHO and the EOS, provide a supervisory function and role and provide the relevant directives to those labour supply agencies as to how their job is to be discussed. I would be the first one to know if there were any problems with any of the companies that provide labour to the government that it then provides to members of our community. I am glad to tell you, Mr. Speaker, that I have not received complaints about those companies that provide labour to the government. And therefore, as I have said, we are perfectly satisfied with the arrangements that we are from having faith. And moreover, I am perfectly satisfied with the provision that is carried out respectively by the GHA, EOS, and the care agency is adequate and sufficient to ensure that the persons that receive those services are perfectly safe and that they are receiving the care that they need.
Speaker, moving on to the now to the labour side and looking at it from the point of view, not from the service user, but from the point of view of the employee. If this type of area, you have a situation where the government pays the recruitment consultant X amount for the labour provided by a specific worker, and then that worker is paid by the recruitment consultant a lesser amount, because the worker that is paid through the care agency and the elderly residential service, the recruitment consultant will make a percentage. What safeguards does the government have in place, or does the government take an interest in ensuring that those workers that are working within the care agency elderly residential services in these numbers are not exploited by recruitment consultants, and that they get a fair amount of their labour, for their labour, for the work that they do in these particular jobs. And that, of course, the recruitment consultants doesn't clean the government and also the worker.
Speaker. In the first place, expectation is quite strong word for the honourable gentleman to use. I once again, they're not recruitment agencies, they're labour supply companies to the government. I really have resisted telling him this since the article supplementary, but he does recall, does he not, that we inherited the system of domiciliary care from them. Of course not, because we provide more care because we care, but because we provide more care because we care more. And therefore, we saw a need to have to increase the domiciliary care package for other members of our community, and that meant having to spend more money, and we did so. And therefore, the fact that there are more care is providing care is, in fact, I would have thought, a very good thing indeed. But, Mr. Speaker, as I said, he has to remember that we inherited that system with him, from him. And I'm telling him that we are satisfied with the system, in respect of obtaining labour from supply labour companies. And once again, I think it lies in his mouth to ask me the last bit of his question. Because, in fact, we have been criticised in that same video that he made when he accused me of not providing him the answers, over which I've answered 15 times, of questioning going for, wait for it, value for money. And he was asking me whether we are on top of obtaining value for money. Mr. Speaker, I know that you do not want me to go back to when they were in government, but even in the course of one supplementary question, that is how you can contradict me. So, Mr. Speaker, he cannot now, or maybe he will, because he certainly has no inherent consistency in what he said inside or outside of the house, but given that he does put a price and opinion now on value for money, yes, that was the reason why we provide, we seek bids on the basis of providing the best value for money for the taxpayer of Gibraltar. And therefore, you can look assured that I, certainly, in respect of the bids in which I have been involved and which I've had advice from my officials in respect of those particular bids, that I am satisfied that the taxpayer of Gibraltar has obtained value for money and the government is not getting cleaned up.
Mr. Speaker. Yes, unfortunately, by dropping the issue and the core of my supplementary question. Undoubtedly, what we have is a situation where the government, let's say, in theory, pays £10 to the recruitment consultant, that's what they are, recruitment consultant, £10 to the recruitment consultant, and the recruitment consultant may pay the minimum wage, to the worker. That means that the recruitment consultant keeps in his pocket the balance between the minimum wage and the £10. And what I'm asking him is, what is the government doing to ensure that workers are not exploited in this kind of situation? Because on the one hand, workers are exploited, and on the other, it is undoubtedly the case that these recruitment consultants are making an awful lot of money at their expense. And indeed, more so than I thought, because I look at these figures, and we are talking about very high levels of workers in these areas who recruitment consultants, Mr. Speaker. What are you doing to prevent exploitation of workers in this situation?
Mr. Speaker, asking for bids in respect of purposes of which you have asked us not to do so. In the first place, I think that I'm afraid that I will have to insist, and it really does pain me to explain the diminishing of employment law to a QC, that they are not recruitment consultants, they are labour supply companies. If they were recruitment consultants, they would be recruiting labour directly for the government, which is exactly what we're criticising last year. So no, they are not recruitment consultants, they are labour supply companies. And the only reason why I'm insisting on the point is only because he's insisted on making the point that they're called recruitment consultants. Well, I don't know if anyone got that time, but certainly not with any company that I deal with, which are recruitment consultants. Mr. Speaker, the law of Gibraltar, I can assure them, is being applied by the labour supply companies of which provide labour to the government. And as I have told him in my answer before, and I think he's intent today, I'm not listening to me, that in respect of the bids in which I have received advice and in respect of which I have been involved, I am satisfied that employee is not being exploited. I have answered that question already, Mr. Speaker.
So the very convenient moment for the House to recess for 15 minutes. I thought we had this.
One more, just one more. I don't want to hog this area of today's session.
But
can we therefore assure the fact that he is satisfied that there are no situations out there in under his responsibility where employees are being paid the minimum wage and you have a situation where the recruitment consultant or the labour supplier or whatever you want to call it is not taking a substantial amount over and above that could go into the pocket of those workers. And are you satisfied that there are no exploited workers who recruitment consultants or whatever he wants to call it in the old and in his responsibility? I'm going to have to reply to the Honourable Gentleman in the manner that I have already done so. The community has a choice, and it's a very simple one. We either continue to provide care, domiciliary care, to the 400, I don't know the exact number before, to the 470 persons who receive domiciliary care, which I think we must all agree is a very good thing. Providing care in the community prevents other harm, which is that people are not cared for at home and therefore end up in hospital, where we can have people who are medically unwell and can only be there for the length of the time that they're medically unwell and then discharged home. The reason why we've been able to maintain a high bed resiliency in the hospital is directly linked to the provision and the increase in domiciliary care, because once the person is medically discharged and is well to go home, that person, for the most part, tends to be elderly persons who would require care. And without that domiciliary care, they would simply be unable to go home, which is why the number keeps increasing. Therefore, as I told them during the course of one of my supplementary answers, if the Honourable Gentleman is suggesting that those 135 care workers should be employed directly, and there is no other way to consider his purpose, it is binary, Mr. Speaker. You either have them through care to labour supply companies, or you have them directly employed. If you have them directly employed, as you must fully understand, the bill would likely go from 2 million to 6 million without addressing the only genuine concern which I think he has raised, which is about continuity of care, because the method of employment does not affect the quality of the care or the issues that arise at the continuity of care. Because a person directly employed or through an agency is going to be quite ill or less ill as many times irrespective of his employer.
I tell him how he can, one of the ways that he can do it, and of course, other ways will be in an excellent manifesto at the next election.
You've got to pay your worker 80% or 85% of what we pay you as an hourly rate for that worker then gets 80-85% in his pocket. But at the moment, I suspect I don't have the figures. But at the moment, I suspect that there are individuals out there that are being paid the minimum wage, which is just over 5 pounds, I think it is, the minimum wage. And then you have a situation where the recruitment agency is, for example, charging £10 or £12 per hour for that individual. And I find that as not being fair, I find that is iniquitous. It's iniquitous for the worker, and it is actually, in my view, iniquitous for the taxpayer.
Piece of information which will predate the Honourable Gentleman's position as Minister for Health. But one of the key things we did when we were elected was we spoke to those labour supply companies, which the Honourable Gentleman likes to call recruitment agencies, and we told them that the fees they were charging then, when they were in government, which were to the region of £15 per worker, were too high, and that they had to reduce them. And the amount that he's talking about now, whether it's £12 or £10, is the greatly reduced price that women pay so that they would not pocket a larger chunk of the amount paid by the taxpayer. And so, Speaker, I will take from what he has taken a backhanded compliment, and I hope that the information I provide the House is helpful in its formulation of questions.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the Minister for Health suggestion, relating to the continuity of care point, and particularly given her suggestion that we're receiving excellent service in relation to the labour supply company providing these individuals to work in our institutions. Is the government satisfied, is he satisfied, as to the standards that are being met by those particular employees that are working in the labour supply company? Because I'm interested to hear how the government monitors the standards of the service that are delivered to the service users. That's the information question. I'm happy to provide you with an overview, and if you want to ask me the next session of Parliament, I will give you the exact way that it's done, because I would like to get the feedback from the professionals that do it. But in terms of overview, I think that the standards that are being demanded by the Fair Agency or the ERF, etc., are the standards that ought to apply. So that I do think that we could do better work in that respect. And to that extent, without wishing to be a statement that I hope to make in due course, there is considerable work being undertaken in terms of formalizing those standards and to have certain benchmarks that are made public by which we can measure that performance. So, whereas at this point in time, I'm happy to go faster with how the supervision and the testing is currently being conducted by professionals in the care agency, because I do trust them to be doing an excellent job in that respect, and I think that they do exactly what is asked of them. I think that we can ask more of ourselves in terms of a community by setting standards higher in terms of the benchmarks by which we measure carers. And that is very much a work in progress, really, and I'm working with that. With certain professionals to agree a framework in that respect, very much as I'm sure they know about the Quality Care Commission. And we will not be reinventing the wheel. We're in fact looking at those standards in the UK to be able to translate them in practice and standards to make sure that they apply in a smaller community like Gibraltar. So, am I satisfied with the factor? Yes. Am I satisfied with the UN? No. I think there is work to be done there to be able to have quality benchmarks by which we can measure the work being conducted by carers. So I think you've got an important point. Mr. Speaker, just one thing, is it right in suggesting that the information in relation to the adherence to the minimum standards of care, and I appreciate the comments that Minister has made to give us some reassurance as to how that's operating at the moment, but the Minister will agree with me that these people are dealing with probably some of the most vulnerable people in our community, particularly patients, and therefore would you agree with me that adherence to minimum standards is fairly limited at the moment and the supervision of it is fairly limited? Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Gentleman, if I may turn it around, can agree with us that the care that is being provided is proving to be a high quality level of care. As I told him, our community is vibrant in many respects, one of which is to write to me in the event of any dissatisfaction with any part of the service. I have to tell him, Mr. Speaker, that in fact, I said this to the Honourable Chief Minister on many occasions, that I do receive high praise for the services that are provided by some of the companies that provide labour to government. But as I've already conceded to him, I'm not trying to be difficult, we are working on benchmarks that I would like to employ in an overarching framework by which we can measure the work being carried out by the carers.
Mr. Speaker, I'm really grateful that the Honourable Minister has actually said that he's looking into the care policy of the Commission. I think that's a really good initiative, and I brought that into the House in my budget speech, in my maiden budget speech in 2016. And I'm really grateful that he's seriously looking into this. I just want to ask the government in relation to a statement they made last week, which we the followers, they will no longer tolerate zero-hour contracts and expect all employees to be contracted part-time or full-time. I think, Mr. Speaker, this will go a long way in providing certainty, stability to the workers, but will also transcend into the continuity of work. This statement is made in a particular case, which is the new contract being given for John Manager Prince. Is this a new policy that the government will be employing all across the board in as it goes, renewing contracts moving forward?
Speaker, I don't want to speak for my honourable colleague, but I can tell him that it's not just in relation to the John Maxwell's home bid. Also, in respect of his size and in respect of the logistics, we've always been very clear to the company that we expect nothing less than employees to have contracts that set out either that are going to be full-time or part-time. That, of course, whether the contract is one or the other will depend on the needs of the service, but also taking into account the wishes expressed by the particular employees.
Well, I think so for 20 minutes. When we come back, we will be dealing with question 259. Question number 259, the Honourable Peter Hayes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 150 of 2018, can the Minister for Health give details of any other assistive devices provided by the Health Authority for those suffering from hearing impairment and associated hearing conditions, together with details of how the person is assessed for their needs and what the cost to the individual could be?
And for the Honourable Minister for Health, question justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 260.
Question number 260, the Honourable E.J.
Phillips. Mr. Speaker, the government has confirmed that those with hearing impediments are provided with a £420 contribution towards hearing aids. Can the government state whether or not, in the event that the higher grade and more costly hearing aids are medically recommended, that the GHA will meet the cost? Mr. Speaker, at present, the Audiology Department only issues hearing aids antennas masters or a combination of many nodes with incorporated masters. These are listed free and do not require internet access. In the case of children needing assistive devices in school, such as radio hearing aids, these are usually obtained by the audiology department but paid for by the Department of Education. The type of assistive device required is recommended by the pediatric assessment team at the Nuffield Centre in London. The radiology department has been called upon for advice by other government departments in respect of assistive devices. In such cases, the GHO is not involved in the assessments for entitlement or installation of the devices. Mr. Speaker, in respect of question 260, yes.
In respect of my question 259, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad to hear that the radio hearing aids and so on and conventional primary education, but what happens to those individuals who are behind sort of education aid? I know a hearing assistance device can be extremely useful, but there are many cases, you know, where, for example, the ability to be able to connect to the loop induction system, you know, is highly recommended. Would perhaps a similar process with feedback coming in, recommendations coming in from medical practitioners to your department, would that be helpful to allow these individuals to at least get part subsidy or whatever to additional devices that in extreme cases are a necessity in order to have a decent quality of life?
Mr. Speaker, I will certainly pass these comments to the relevant department and clinicians. Given that we do provide advice as respect to radio hearing aids obtained by the audiology department, I do not see why that is not a service that will not be provided by the GHO. Secondly, if there's a clinical need for it, then the GHO is at best to pay for it. So I'll take his comments back to the audiology department and ask the question and I will write to him.
And I think we'll go to Mr. Speaker, the minister can look into that. I mean, can we as well with your leave, if you could come to sort of like a general agreement that we leave it in abeyance till perhaps the budget session by which time we will have had an opportunity to look to it and we can raise this matter then as a way forward to those who are with, you know, hearing impairment.
Depending on either tomorrow and that afternoon, depending on whether we come to the staff or whether we go back to the office, I'm sure they'll be able to have an answer for him either tomorrow or in the early part of next week.
Question number 261, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state whether it has consulted the public at large in respect to the proposed move to the primary care centre?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there has been extensive and intricate consultations with all multidisciplinary teams with respect to design and layout over the last 14 months for both the primary community centre and the pediatric centre. Feedback received from our service users as to the present primary care centre but also factored during the design stages. Mr. Speaker, another tale of time, I feel incredibly privileged to serve our community and to work with so many excellent professionals to improve our healthcare services. The new primary care community centre is the culmination of our endeavours towards enabling clinicians to guide and lead our patients' needs by always placing them at the heart of everything that we do. I'm enormously pleased to see the diligent work and devotion of our healthcare professionals and our dedicated staff of the GHO have enabled this incredibly exciting project to come finally to fruition. I am confident that we will deliver a primary care centre and pediatric centre which will enhance our services to our community and serve us well for now and also in the future.
If I carefully listen to your answer, just as far as the extensive, intricate views taken from the teams within the GHO and that service users' views were factored in. My question related to public consultation, so therefore the answer to the question is, we assume no, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, correct. There was no formal public consultation in respect of the move to the new PPP landscape.
Stephen, I'm grateful to make the example. Can I just ask, please, from a financial point of view, as to what the anticipated cost of this move would be, and whether it be borne by the Improvement Development Fund, the hospital itself, or some other source?
Mr. Speaker, can you ask me as it is well, and expertise in respect of financial matters, of which I do not have the information before me, so I cannot tell him from which fund the money will come from. What I can tell him, however, Mr. Speaker, is that the reason why the announcement was not made until 14 months after I was appointed Minister for Health is because during the course of those 14 months, apart from working very hard on the designs of the new PCC, which will be a bespoke facility for primary care health and also for pediatric health, integrating primary and secondary inpatient care for children in this hub, the developer will be the entity that pays for the new build, and therefore the government will not be paying for the capital of that build, but will instead be paying a rent. And in the course of those negotiations, we have spent a lot of time trying to knuckle down on the best possible rent to be paid to the developer once the new PPC is built. I have to tell him also that there is a capital investment that the government will be making. I do not know from which subhead or from which fund that capital money will come from, but that capital investment relates to the entrance to the new primary care centre, which is going to be on the front of the existing hospital, so that patients can access the new PPC from there. So there will be some investments in that respect, and there are also other items of capital expenditure which I don't have in front of me, so I won't have it just as now, because I do not want to unintentionally mislead the House. But again, during the next session of the House, I will be able to tell you exactly what the capital investment is and how much rental will be paid.
Mr. Peter, I'm extremely grateful to Mr. Ryan for the way that they give me something to work on I guess understand the logic in replicating the model that was used to finance the hospital itself. From a fair release back, I imagine. But I will ask more direct questions on that in the future. Can I ask you, Mr. does it have a time frame for the building of the infrastructure that will be required to facilitate the move in primary care?
Mr. Speaker, before I answer the question that was asked, to be clear, this is not a sale and lease back arrangement. This is a developer building, a new build for which will be used by the government. That is, it's not like a present arrangement for the Hawthorne Bennett Hospital, where the government currently pays, if I recall correctly, over £4 million a year. So we are not using that template, in fact, we will be paying a rent. Now, whether or not the government has the option to buy that at a particular point in time, I cannot remember at the time. Again, if you were to ask me those specific questions, I will come back to the House and provide them with the answers. And in respect of time frames, I am, if I recall again the health terms correctly, I do recall that the pediatric hub will be ready by the end of March, I think, of next year, and the new PPC will be ready by the end of July, or the end of June of next year. I am talking from memory, and therefore I will not want to be quoted in that respect, but again, if you ask me specifically, I will check the heads of terms, and of course I will be able to provide an answer to the Honourable Gentleman and the next person of the House.
Speaker, just one further question, which will be the announcement that the government made in relation to the PCC and Pediatric Centre has confirmed that the new primary care centre is due to open the first half of 2019. The minister didn't expect any slippage into the second half of 2019, but I know that he wasn't too sure on the answer to Mr. Clinton's question, but he doesn't expect that to move into the second half of the year.
No, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is right in noticing a hesitancy, but not the reason why. The reason why we're hesitant this is it. I do not want to tell the honourable gentleman a particular month to then check the House of Terms and find that it was actually the end of May and not the end of March. But as I say, for many, the House of Terms stipulate that both centres will be delivered to the government in the first part of the next year, but it cannot be called the exact month. If you ask me in the next for the next session, I will have the answers for you.
Question number 262, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state which services for GOP are currently recommending or contemplating repatriating?
Mr. Speaker, the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 263 and 264.
Question number 263, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state the number of people under 18 years of age that have been seen by us in emergency as a result of alcohol and drug misuse every month in the last 12 months?
Question number 264, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Of those children currently in care, can the government state the number that present with mental health issues?
Mr.
Speaker, the GSO is contemplating the feasibility of repatriating as many services to Gibraltar as possible, including interventional cardiology, MRI, spinal surgery, pediatric surgery, and extending our urology services. Then, the GHO has repatriated the following services: urology service, February 2016, chemotherapy, September 2016, bariatric surgery, January 2017, colorectal surgery, June 2017, breast surgery services, January 2018, pediatric cardiology clinics, January 2018, vascular surgery services, January 2018, and thyroid surgery, February 2018. There have been a total of 50 attendances to the A&E department of people under the age of 18 as a result of alcohol and drug misuse in the last 12 months. There are no children in care with mental health issues.
Insofar as the Minister's answer to 262-2018 is concerned, am I right in thinking, Mr. Speaker, that of those that the government intend to repatriate in relation to paediatrics, cardiology and neurology, that that would fit within the existing repatriated services, and therefore would that mean that there would be not an additional cost to those repatriated? Of course, there will always be an element of cost to those services, because the policy of the government is to ensure that our service can be offered as wide as possible for the community. But does the government factor in the fact that the existing infrastructure and the teams would be able to perform those with newly repatriated services?
Mr. Speaker, I think that I have understood the Honourable Gentleman's question, but in respect of the services that I've mentioned to him that we have repatriated, certainly in my time, since January 17 to February 18, unless my staff corrects me and send me an email if I am incorrect, every single repatriation has required additional human resources. And therefore, I think we can safely assume, although I will double check this for him because I do not want to unintentionally mislead the House, all of the other services that we wish to repatriate, interventional cardiology, MRI, spinal surgery, pediatric surgery, will require additional human and, of course, capital resources, because we will require the equipment to be able to provide those services, and also the concomitant costs in respect of maintenance and servicing.
I assume, Mr. Speaker, that it would seem to me from someone who doesn't have the figures to hand in relation to, for example, spinal surgery or complicated pediatric surgery, that there would be a significant cost to the not only the infrastructure, the hiring of human resources to deal with these types of operations, but that what the government consider when it's weighing up repatriation, the ability to outsource these issues
and the cost of those outsourcing vis-a-vis the hiring of further human resources in terms of cardiologists, consultants, surgeons in relation to those services. In addition to the budget.
Mr. Speaker, the discussion to the passport is not the complicated nature to set, but there are various variables that are taken into account. One of them is whether or not it is the policy of the GHA to provide services in-house. The answer, of course, is that yes, it is preferable always to be able to provide medical, clinical, and surgical services at home so that patients do not have to undergo the stresses of travel. So that would always be the answer to that particular question. Then the question becomes, if that is the policy, will the repatriation be more expensive or less expensive? And if it is more expensive, is it prohibitively expensive, or is it an expense that is over greater manageable? We have found so far, and that is not to say that it will always be the case, but we have found so far that the services that we have repatriated, although it will increase the cost in terms of salaries and equipment, because we're bringing over surgeons and nurses and any other clinician that is required to provide a service within the GHA, that the cost of sending a digitalian patient out with all the inconvenience and stress that that entails is in fact beneficial to the taxpayer. In other words, to date, all the repatriated services are more cost effective than referring one of our patients to a testing centre. But the reason why I say that it's not a straightforward formula is because, of course, there's also the other option of having visiting consultants, which we have also increased. And I know you're going to ask me about that, but it relates to the supplementary question that you asked me. I don't have the figures to hand. I don't have the costs to hand. Do you know exactly how much, for example, the urology repatriation has cost, versus how much it used to cost to send people outside? I would be delighted to provide you with that information. But there will always be, as I am continually advised by my commission, services that can be provided in-house. Open heart surgery is the example of the most often provided. In those cases, it makes sense to have the surgeon come to Gibraltar as a visiting consultant to provide the service. The reason why we can't have certain specialisms in Gibraltar is because the surgeon, in order not to be still, has to be able to operate all the time. And therefore, we can have a visiting surgeon come and do our operation, but then we cannot keep him, because to keep him here means that they would actually lose their GMC registration licensing for becoming disabled. So it is a combination of keeping services, rather, sensitive patients going to the extent that those services are best provided away from Gibraltar, to repatriate all those services that are best provided in Gibraltar, and for those where we think that it is best provided in Gibraltar that we can provide the service, to have this visiting consultants.
Question number 265,
the other is Joe Phillips. Are those children currently in care? Can the government state how long those children have been in care?
To the
Mr. Speaker, those children currently in care, the length of time in care ranges from 6 months, being the shortest period. So, Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 266.
My apologies. Question number 266, the answer is
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm what programs are available for families struggling to cope with children who have behavioural issues?
Mr.
Speaker, my apologies for jumping the gun, but sometimes it's hard not to cross the buzzer when you know the answer. Mr. Speaker, although children came to care, the length of time in care ranges from 6 months, being the shortest period, to 9 years and 6 months, being the longest period. There are currently two specific parenting programs aimed at supporting parents and carers married to the children's behavioural problems. These are the Incredible Years program and the Time Out for Parents program. Further to this, each child knows the children's school will have either a child protection or child in need plan. Within this plan, the social worker will have identified any specific program to support families if they are struggling to cope with the children's behavioural issues. All plans will be tailor-made to meet the needs of each individual child.
Question number 257, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the number of soldiers and nationality of those persons detained for tobacco and tobacco-related offences in the last 24 months?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the number of persons detained for tobacco and tobacco-related offences in the last 24 months is in the schedule. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman.
Question number 268, the Honourable Tian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, would government reconsider its zero tolerance policy towards any employer modifications by residents to their homes at Charles Bouffon House, particularly where there are medical grounds as to why these should be made, such as replacing shower units with a bath, where the latter is more suitable for the resident?
And for the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, Charles Bouffon House is a brand new purpose-built accommodation for the elderly, which has been designed with input from occupational therapists and other professionals. The block was completed last year, so tenants moved in very recently. Flats were offered to prospective tenants on the basis that no alterations to the flats could be made, and this was a condition of them accepting the flats.
And Mr. Speaker, that is understood. However, can the Minister see that it is possible, particularly when we look at the demographic of the residents of Charles Bouffon House, that over a period of time, relatively short space of time, potentially, that their medical conditions, or they may develop medical conditions or have existing medical conditions which may become aggravated, and that it may therefore necessitate or be important for quality of life that certain changes with appropriate clinical support be made to those residences, and that having an absolute zero tolerance policy may not be appropriate.
Mr. Speaker, these flats are specifically designed for that. They have been designed with elderly people in the worst stages of their life in mind on the advice of professionals. And the design is purely on the advice of professionals so that people may remain independent for longer. In this case that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to, someone now wants a bath instead of a shower, that would completely compromise the whole ethos of this building. Mr. Speaker, they are very welcome to ask for an exchange for a house that would be suitable for them with a bath, but certainly not in a brand new building which has been designed in a particular way to accommodate elderly people in a particular way and at great expense to the taxpayer.
But this is because certainly the Minister will accept at least that it is possible for people to develop medical conditions which may necessitate certain modifications in the property. They may become wheelchair bound and therefore need access, they may need light switches, move to lower positions. Who knows? There's a whole plethora of possible medical conditions that can affect. So to have a zero tolerance policy rather than a case by case we'll analyse and just see if there are medical grounds for making a change. It just seems a little bit harsh that you would ask somebody to move from their home rather than allow them, possibly out of their own expense, and with appropriate approval to make modifications.
Mr. Speaker, I still don't think the Honourable Gentleman understands. These flats have been designed to accommodate people with advanced medical conditions. The Honourable Gentleman has referred to people who are wheelchair bound. In terms of people who are wheelchair users, Mr. Speaker, because I don't like to refer to people who are wheelchair bound, like my Honourable colleague. Dr. Gordes referred to the Honourable Gentleman to my leaflet on language etiquette and disability. I would refer the Honourable Gentleman to the same document, and that he might find enlightening. But these flats are already built and designed for people who may be wheelchair users. The flat switches have already been designed for people who may have mobility issues. In this case, the seat of someone who was allocated a flat recently now wants a bath instead of a shower. Mr. Speaker, the answer is no, because it has been designed at tremendous expense for it to be in for the bathroom to accommodate people with severe disabilities, and the medical advice that we have is that this is appropriate. Mr. Speaker, if they didn't want to shower because they particularly wanted a bath at the time when they were offered this flat very recently, and which they accepted on the basis that they could make no alterations, then they could very perfectly have rejected that flat and asked for a flat that had a bath, in which case they would have been allocated a flat elsewhere with a bath, but not here, Mr. Speaker. It's not a question about it having a zero tolerance. A policy, Mr. Speaker, it's about us having made a great investment in time and from the advice of professionals in the design, which we are very happy with and very satisfied with. And of course, Mr. Speaker, this comes at taxpayers' expense. We certainly look at this on a case-by-case basis, and on this case, Mr. Speaker, the incurring taxpayers' expense is not justified.
I think the minister gave a clue as to what the policy is there. I'm actually referring to some, maybe a huge assumption in referring to a particular case. I'm not referring to a particular case. I'm referring to a policy in general as it's been described to me. Now, the minister is telling me that actually they do look at cases on a case by case basis, and there is scope for modifications to be made appropriately when medical conditions demand it. Then I would accept that answer, and I'm sure the residents of Charles and Son would accept that answer, because that wouldn't then be a zero tolerance policy. So that's what the minister is saying, that there isn't a zero tolerance policy, but there is scope for modification and the right conditions and on a case by case basis. I have to accept that answer.
Even though it doesn't seem to listen to the answer, Mr. Speaker, no one has said that there is a zero tolerance policy, because the other gentleman has invented it. We always try to help. We always look at cases on a case-by-case basis, and we weigh that in what is in the best interest of everybody, Mr. Speaker. And I know that this arises from a particular case, because there's only one case in which this application has been made. And Mr. Speaker, the answer is no, because we have just invested a lot of money on the advice of medical professionals, and in this case, this was accepted by the individuals in question very, very recently, and circumstances have not changed. Therefore, the government has made a decision which I think and I agree is perfectly justified. No one is talking about zero tolerance policies, Mr. Speaker. There is no such thing, particularly when talking about vulnerable people and elderly people. We will try to help, but we will help in the best way.
So, just for clarity, the minister did not refute the fact that in my question I raised the minister as a zero tolerance policy. He basically responded, the other lady, basically responded in a manner that indicated the premise in her question was correct. The other lady has now moved on from that position, and I'm very gratified that she has. And she has, I believe, that she's just confirmed it one more time, confirmed to me that there is scope for modification on a case by case basis, that no modifications have been applied for that have been accepted at this stage is understood and appreciated.
Yes. We are verging on the hypothetical here, because the reality is that it is unlikely that we will be asked for modification because of the way that these flats have been designed. We have had the input, I thought, once again, of medical professionals to make it, the design the best way possible to ensure independent living for our elderly community for as long as possible. We simply do not envisage after the hours and hours that were spent by the professionals in the design of these flats that they require anything else.
I just need to go back to 267, the schedule that was handed over to me. Can the Minister just clarify the difference in the year 2016 to 2017 in relation to persons arrested? And in relation to the second schedule, but both the British local and British civilian, and then British in the second column, how does that, I'm not sure what he means by the schedule, probably. So, in so far as the schedule that he handed over to us for those persons arrested,
In the second column to the right, it goes to British local 9, and a column below, British to return and British at the bottom of that. British local, what does that mean insofar as a reference? I assume it means British to return, but not. Thank you. Thank you.
Question number 269, the
Honourable Inquiry. The Canada government provides details outlined otherwise of its plans to build further homes for rental.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to my answer to question 168 of 2018. Announcements will be made in due course.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm aware of the Honourable Lady's answer to the question, but since then, of course, Action for Housing has been pressing her, and there is, of course, understandably, genuine interest as to the revelation that the Honourable Lady made at the last sitting, and therefore, if the Honourable Lady is willing to make another set of revelations so that we can have another triplet of the plans which she intends to deal with in relation to rental building. I think it's rather really heard this and all the other references the Honourable Gentleman has made out of the debate, and we will make an announcement as a government and we're ready to do so.
Question number 217, the Honourable Minister.
Can government indicate to the House whether it is aware of damp issues within flats and by the state and how it puts them right? If or when alerted to them, such as the average turnaround time to cure such issues.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the Housing Department is aware that there are reports of damp in Barrow estate in the same way that there will be in all the other housing estates. Reports of damp are processed by the Housing Department when such complaints are reported with a target date of 3 months for completion. Mr. Speaker, I was asked to visit one particular flat which has been suffering from damp issues which just keep getting worse and worse for years, and basically they seem to be tired of calling the housing department. That's why I wanted to find out about the typical turnaround times in case it was a standard that it would take this long. So in light of what the minister has just said, would she be happy to prioritize this house because people are elderly and they have the serious issues as a result? Would they be happy to prioritize this matter and treat this particular flat as soon as possible? Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Lady genuinely wanted us to expedite this matter, which obviously sounds serious, then all the Honourable Lady had to do was to go on the other matter than other occasions, pick up the phone, call me and give me the name and the address, and I would have looked into it immediately. The Housing Department, of course, receives hundreds, sometimes thousands, of complaints in relation to works, some are major works, some are minor works, but the volume is tremendous. It may well be that as a result of human error, this may well have well slipped the net. So I will ask the Honourable Lady to confidentially give me the name and the address, and I will, of course, look into it. But Mr. Speaker, genuinely, if something comes to someone's attention which is serious, then is it really, Mr. Speaker, a matter for a final question and not really a matter for, you know, someone to be kept if you pick up the phone and we will help without the need of parliamentary business time? Mr. Speaker, I appreciate the Minister's answer and also her willingness to get this matter on track. And I do agree that there are some matters that I have called her on and she has assisted, but then there are several other emails that I have sent over the last year that I'm still waiting for a reply, and I thought that this was worthy of flagging up in order to capture her attention and ensure that this issue got sorted out as soon as possible.
Question number 271, the Honourable Alice Lamont.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, with reference to Daisy Terraces, Cumberland Terraces, Nelson's View, Beachley Terraces, and Mount Avenue, can the government give a breakdown of sales details for each as follows: A,
how many flats have been sold with 100% financing from the purchaser? B, how many have been sold with a 50-50 ratio? And C, how many have been sold at 10 the ratio and specify what the ratio is?
And for the angle, we ask for higher than quality.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the honourable gentleman to my answer in Parliament question 108 of 2017.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable minister provided an answer that this is a public document and suggests that the opposition spend £12,000 in breach of an answer. Mr. Speaker, I would like to refer back to question 943 of 2011. Well, your position then, the government today, asked the same question and got a very detailed answer by the government back then. Is this the time for change that is promised?
Mr. Speaker, this is the same question that you have asked me orally as well in the past, and at no point, Mr. Speaker, was this raised on the last occasion when I answered. In the same way. Because this is answer from the same position, Mr. Speaker, that we have taken in relation to when the honourable members on the opposite side ask for information that may well be available at company site by undertaking a company search. This is the exact same thing, Mr. Speaker. It's information that is available publicly. In any way, Mr. Speaker, in relation to the Bayview Cumberland announcing in any event, Mr. Speaker, as the honourable gentleman may recall, I know that he's not part of the GFD now, but he was part of the GFD in the political election, and these are all estates that were sold by the GFD, not by the government, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, that's besides the point is that back in 2011, the level of transparency given back then was a lot higher, and what we're receiving now is a direction from the Honourable Minister to go to Land Property Services and conduct a search of £12,000 in order to obtain an answer which could be given in this house. Mr. Speaker, and the fact that Bayview and Cumberland and Nelsons were sold by the previous administration, there are properties within those estates which were even sold by this administration. Therefore, will the government provide the answer that I have asked for on two occasions in this house? And the fact is that this question I happened to come across whilst researching what they were given by the previous administration whilst they were in opposition.
Mr. Speaker, it's not information. I don't think, Mr. Speaker, that it's something that would cost that amount. Had I been aware, Mr. Speaker, I wasn't aware that something like this would cost in that region. But Mr. Speaker, bearing in mind that more than 50% of the question that I'm being asked relates to housing estates that were built and sold by the GFD, Mr. Speaker. So that is before my time. But nevertheless, it's still information that is publicly available. The other point that I make, Mr. Speaker, is that this point could clearly have been made orally on the last occasion. What we are having is the extension of what could have been on the last occasion more properly a supplementary, and we could have had this debate on the last occasion. But perhaps, one of the gentlemen, I think it needed more time to formulate this, Mr. Speaker. I think that perhaps given time, I'm happy to prepare a schedule of this information. Mr. Speaker, I don't think that it's necessarily appropriate that I am accountable to this house to give information that relates to estates that were built and sold by the GFD. We got have to ask staff to undertake this exercise thoroughly. Clearly, it will relate to sales that, or properties that were sold post 2011, if you cannot pre 2011. And Mr. Speaker, I'm happy to provide that information and I will see if I can get somebody to provide that. Wouldn't have been available, that information would not have been available on this occasion, but I will, given more time, Mr. Speaker, perhaps by the next parliamentary session, I will ensure that I have that information and that information up to date. But certainly, Mr. Speaker, in relation to goals which we have undertaken since we have been in government. Mr. Speaker, the majority of the sales are certainly the first three estates which have taken place before 2011, because there were developments that were developed by the GSD.
Now, Mr. Speaker, I think the Minister of Commerce has said now to provide some information to avoid sort of supplementary coming on later on. Yes, I agree with the Minister that the majority of the houses referring to Davie, Cumberland and Nelson and so on will have taken place prior to 2011. But there have been transactions in several houses post December 2011, and I certainly would be interested in that information, because a tenant who bought a home, purchaser who bought originally prior to December 2011, has yet to amend a book for a sale later on. So that information will probably come out in my supplementary. If I were to give the Minister the advance warning when she goes back to 200 or staff, then they know which direction I'm going to be heading my supplementary as well.
Mr. Speaker, that is information that can be derived. But I suspect that is a huge exercise and is very, very unlikely to be ready by the next sitting of this Parliament. We're looking at all transactions of these affordable housing since 2011. Some premises may have changed ownership more than once. We're talking about a substantial volume of ownership. I will look into it, Mr. Speaker. I think it's an exercise that would be quite onerous and quite unlikely to be ready in a month.
I will add to Mr. Speaker, who may not have the minister when she embarked on this exercise. I remember Dr. Hazia used to ask questions when he was contributing to his benefit. And he received an answer which satisfied him at the time, and I think that would probably satisfy me too. He was through the land sale register. He said, then from there, I derived, you know, so with respect to flats and Campbell and Telford, and it's easier to go to that way rather than searching each individual property. See, so the ledger of the transaction on sale.
We now move to question 286. And the question is the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, has a health and safety investigation been carried out of the recent scaffolding collapse at Oakland Spa Plaza? And what were the results of that investigation? Were any recommendations made to avoid future occurrences? And what were those recommendations?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Speaker, the health and safety inspector has investigated the recent scaffolding collapse at Oakland Spa Plaza. As part of the investigation, the materials used were tested and found to conform to the relevant specifications. Only the east elevation of the facade was affected. The west elevation remained intact. The determining factor on the collapse was the swirling child effect of the wind, which at times reached speeds of 117 kilometers per hour. The health and safety inspector recommended the doubling of securing eyeballs, holding the scaffold in place, as well as the connecting of the scaffold modules all the way to the top and back to back with steel ties, and the avoidance of continuous non-perforated materials along the perimeter of the site. I'm informed, Mr. Speaker, that the recommendations have been accepted and the work carried out to the satisfaction of the health and safety inspector.
I very much thank the Minister and the Health and Safety Inspectorate for having conducted that investigation speedily and actually come up with some very solid recommendations. Will those recommendations now be taken forward to other potential sites which may suffer similar, you know, be in a similar area or similar wind conditions to ensure that perhaps we wouldn't be affected in the same way, or that future sites may not be affected in the same way, or will those recommendations only be applied to this particular development?
Mr. Speaker, the issue is specific to this particular site. There are, of course, regular inspections by the health and safety inspectors in all the sites around people, so that's part of their job, it's part of what they do
scaffolding itself had complied with all necessary health and safety measures. So, scaffolding that was in force only present in the erection of the scaffolding or the fixing of the scaffolding, but the combined effect of the wind with the non-perforated seating. The recommendation obviously was to remove the non-perforated seating and to replace it with a perforated seating. I say that the purpose of the seating is really for dust control in respect of the area. A non-perforated seating has greater effect in terms of dust control, but has the problem of trapping the wind and causing it. So why not the perforated seating will allow the wind through, it is less effective in controlling the dust going from the worst going into other areas. So clearly the compromise that has to be reached is that a seating has to be used with passive preparation, which does allow the wind to go through, but which does also conform with the requirements in terms of dust control. That is the balance that has to be struck. In this particular case, the company opted for more dust control without anticipating that this would be the effect, but that has now been corrected.
And Mr. Speaker, I think that the Minister has pointed out what most people suggest, that the seating is certainly a significant factor in that particular collapse. But he's also referred to other recommendations about the doubling of the number of eye bolts in the scaffolding. And I just wonder if in other developments in that area, because we are likely to see some developments in that area, I'm assuming, it wouldn't be worth applying those same standards of doubling the eye bolts, taking the lessons learned from this particular collapse and just through the planning process, perhaps, just to ensure that we don't experience anything similar, or at least reduce the chance of anything similar occurring in the future.
Do the honourable members mention that I indicated that the principal factor was the people, in fact, it was the determining factor. As I indicated earlier, the way the scaffolding had been put up and the eyeballs that had been put in place to secure the scaffolding conformed to all health and safety standards. So that in itself wasn't a problem. Certainly the health and safety inspectors will be very astute as to problems with wind, and they will want to ensure that this did not have the heat in other sites. And they will be, or they have been carrying out the inspections to make sure that the eyeballs properly secure the scaffolding. But in this particular case, the problem was not the eyeballs. The problem was the seating that was used, and that has now been replaced.
I did some research in relation to this for other reasons, not specifically because of this site, but what the problem? I know the problem was the actual that they're seating that effectively acted as a type of sail. So with the wind acting as a sail, it just dragged the scaffolding over. But this type of seating is designed, the way that it's connected to the scaffolding is through weight connections that are designed to effectively disengage when there are strong winds. And it appears that in this case, my information is that in this case, what happened was that it was tied very strongly on a permanent basis, and when the seat actually caught the wind, it just couldn't release. Now, is that something the Honourable Gentleman has in the information that's been provided to him? Because that's what I've been told was the problem in this particular case.
I can't see anything just looking at trying to address the issue that the Honourable Member has mentioned. So the information I have been provided, I cannot see anything which mentions specifically these particular methods of plan which is supposed to release, but I'm happy to look at it and get back to the Honourable Member.
Question number 287, the Honourable Team Hammond.
The government intends to carry out a health and safety investigation of the recent incident where a piece of metal fell from Waterfall Place.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Mr.
Speaker, the health and safety investigation of the recent incident has been fascinated by the health and safety sector, so they are investigating this.
Question number 288, the Honourable Colin Hammond.
Can government provide the total visitor expenditure figures by month from July to December 2017?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
That the tourist expenditure figures for the whole of 2017 are currently being compiled by the government statistics office and are currently and are therefore not available. They're being compiled for the whole of the year 2017. The latest tourist expenditure figures are included in the tourist survey report 2016, which is available on the government website. Tourist expenditure estimates are not compiled by month. They are calculated as a total sum of the expenditure from six categories of visitors. Visitors are arrivals at hotels, excursionists from cruises, visitors on yachts, visitors in supplementary accommodation, in-transit visitors, and excursionists from sailing. Monthly expenditure figures are therefore not available.
Question number 299, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Stephen, can the government please advise if it has given any approval for general borrowing under Section 47 of the Universal Developer Act 2015, and if so, to what amount and purpose?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation Report.
Speaker, for answer this question with question 290 of 2018.
Question number 290,
the Honourable Alan Clinton. Mr. Speaker, can you please advise if it has given any approval for the university's mortgage generous land on the Section 40, Subsection 2 of the University Developer Act 2015, and if so, for what amount and purpose?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
The Speaker, the government has not given approval for any general borrowing under Section 47, or for the University to mortgage any of its land under Section 42 of the University of Gibraltar Act 2015. As no request has been made by the university for either purpose.
Speaker, I move that the House should now adjourn to Monday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon.
According to the Chief Minister, we were discussing the question of the requirement about the estimate of expenditure, as I have indicated. I think we may be able to review the matter now, or we can do it on between now and Monday.
Speaker, I've had a preliminary look, but I need to check two other sources for my recollection so I can put something to you and to the class, which is properly researched, and also the understanding of others in my office. So I'll do that in time for Monday.
I will therefore adjourn to Monday, the 26th, I think it is, of March, at 3 in the afternoon.